Hi, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, April. Oh goodness, what is today's date? I think it's the 13th, April 13th. Yep, 2015. Okay, we broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140. Participant code is 385-698. So I'll say that again, 605-562-3140, and the code is 385-698. Okay, all radio hosts are invited into the queue if they have a question or a comment. If anyone would like to ask a question through the email, you can send questions to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org, and we'll try to answer your questions next week. I think we do have one question that came in for this week, and we'll pick it up a little later. Please support our business partners, of which the proceeds go to support the National Liberty Alliance effort. That's New Mana Foods and East End Rare Coins. You can find their icons on the right side of our website. For more information, you click on their banners. Okay, also please support us by donating $5 a month or more. Keep us going and continuing the work that we're doing. Let's start off. We'll take a moment to look into the Lord's mind here. Tonight's scripture reading is Proverbs chapter 3. We're going to be reading verses 27 through 35. So Proverbs chapter 3, 27 through 35. Withhold not good from them to whom it is due, when it is in the power of thine hand to do it. Say not unto thy neighbor, go and come again tomorrow, and I will give thee when thou hast it by thee. Devise not evil against thy neighbors, seeing he dwelleth securely by thee. Strive not with a man without cause, if he have done thee no harm. Envy thou not the oppressor, and choose none of his ways. For the forward is an abomination to the Lord, but his secret is with the righteous. The curse of the Lord is in the house of the wicked, but he blesseth the habitation of the just. Surely he scorneth the scorners, but he giveth grace unto the lowly. The wise shall inherit glory, but the shame shall be the promotion of fools. Okay, that was God's Word, Proverbs chapter 3, verses 27 through 35. Okay, tonight the topic is going to be, we're going to be looking at the Magna Carta. Actually, we have two papers, but I don't know how much time it's going to take to get through the Magna Carta. I don't think it's going to take very long. But we may do both papers. If not, we'll do the other one next week. So the first one we're going to look at is the Magna Carta. And then if we have time this week, we'll be looking at a writ of error. Both of these papers have been uploaded to nationallibertyalliance.org. You can get a copy up there, nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on the Media tab, and then just come down just a little bit, and you'll see it says Legal Documents, and right under the Legal Documents, you will find these papers. You'll find them in PDF and in Word. Again, one is the first one is Magna Carta. And the second one is writ of error. So I'm looking to make sure it's there. Yep, it's the last one, writ of error, W-R-I-T. Okay, so let's look at the Magna Carta. What I did is the Magna Carta is kind of difficult to read. It's written in the old language. There's a lot of things they talk about on their own, what's going on in their own day. They mention individual names and situations and events and things that don't necessarily affect us today. So what I've done is I've gone through the Magna Carta to try to bring it up to today's appreciation, ultimately and specifically focusing in on the rights of mankind, which is what the Magna Carta was all about. It's the Great Charter. So we gave an interpretation to the modern language, and we applied this to the United States of America. And so as we're reading, it almost reads like the Bill of Rights, as a matter of fact. I knew there was quite a bit in here, but as I went through it, I didn't realize how many of the points that they really touch on is in our Bill of Rights. Clearly, Thomas Jefferson looked at this document very carefully. Not Thomas Jefferson. Who was it that wrote the Bill of Rights? I forget. But anyway, clearly our founding fathers got together. As a matter of fact, it was the Anti-Federalist. I don't remember exactly who was chosen to pen it, but of course it was written by many people, ultimately. And so when they brought this work together, the Bill of Rights, again, they clearly have been looking at the Magna Carta. So it starts off, and again, the language has changed to focus in on our perspective here in the United States. But we changed certain words, but of course the focus is on God. So there is a very, very strong focus on God, particularly Christianity and Christ himself. So we're not going to eliminate all that, obviously. That is our heritage. The preamble it starts off with. As a matter of fact, there was sort of a lead-in. Let me look at this quickly. I'm not sure who wrote this, but I'll read this first. It's only about two sentences that leads into the Magna Carta. Abuses by our elected and appointed servants caused a revolt by the people who compelled them to execute this recognition of rights for all people. It established the principles that no one, including judges and legislators, are above the law. Now, on this paper, by the way, we have footnotes on every paragraph, and some paragraphs I left out because it just doesn't work for our day. It was really focused in on their day and specific situations, as I mentioned earlier. But the ones that does apply to us that we can really get some good meat out of, obviously, are the ones we chose. And we have footnotes for each one of these paragraphs that we write here. So you can look at the original language of the paragraph to see once for yourself if we're interpreting it correctly or not. Starts off with the preamble, and it says, "The governor of the universe, by his own grace, King of the United States of America," and again, we're focusing this in on our day and our nation, because this is our law. This is the foundation of the law that we, the people, have established under the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. "By his own grace, King of the United States of America, to elected and appointed stewards, greetings. Know that having regard to God and for the salvation of our souls, and those of all of our ancestors and heirs, and unto the honor of God, and the advancement of the body of Christ, and of the remedying of our realm, we have granted as underwritten by advice of our founding fathers. We the people, granted by God, and by this our present charter, confirmed for us and our heirs forever, that the body of Christ shall be free, and shall have all their unalienable rights intact, and we obtain that it be thus observed, among them the freedom of elections, which is the most important and essential to the body of Christ. We of our pure and unconstrained will did ordain, and did by our charter confirm, and did obtain the ratification of the same from our Lord, the Governor of the universe, through his word. Before the quarrel arose between us and our judges, and this we will observe, and our will is that it be observed in good faith by our heirs forever. We have also granted to all people of our kingdom for us and our heirs forever all the underwritten liberties to be had and held by them and their heirs of us and our heirs forever." So that was paragraph one. We're going to now go to paragraph 13. Like I said, there's quite a few paragraphs in here that just doesn't apply to our time. 13, all people have unalienable rights and shall be free from direct taxes. 14, all people have the right to obtain counsel. 17, appellate courts shall be set in fixed areas. 18, county court jurisdiction shall be set with circuit judges. 19. All judicial business shall be attended to before circuit judges move to the next county. 26. If anyone dies in debt, his property will be seized until debts are settled and the remainder be given to his wife and children. 27. If anyone dies without a will, his property shall be distributed to his nearest kinsfolk under the supervision of the church. 28. Personal property rights. 29. Performance of duty is required. 30. No sheriff shall take the horses or carts for transport duty without permission. 31. Land property rights. 33. Right of waterway, rivers and streams, shall not be obstructed. 34. The writ, which is called precipice, which really is focusing in on the problems of summary judgment that we plague our courts, and apparently plagued them back in their day too. The writ, which is called precipice, shall not be issued whereby a free man will lose his court. Matter of fact, our United States Supreme Court has ruled that the only thing necessary to make a case prima facie is an affidavit. And by the way, if there is no affidavit in the court, there is no case. There is no court. There's no court has been opened. 35. Trade shall be made regular throughout the land. 38. Warrants require sworn affidavits of a credible witness. 39. Right of due process. 40. Free courts access, no fees. You shouldn't have to pay to get into a court. Matter of fact, the writ of error that we might read tonight deals with that problem. 41. Trade shall be made regular between nations. 42. Right to travel. 43. If anyone holding property dies without heirs, the state will take control. 44. Court cases shall be heard within the jurisdiction that they arise. 45. Justices, constables, sheriffs, and bailiffs shall serve only during good behavior. 48. Lana's language is very familiar to the Bill of Rights. 48. All evil customs shall be judged by 12 honest men, that is the jury, and be utterly abolished. That's jury nullification. 51. No foreign armies shall be on the land. Today they tell us we have 350,000 foreign troops. We hear reports from many, many other sources, more like 650,000. No foreign armies shall be on the land. 52. If anyone has been deposed or removed without the legal judgment of his peers from his lands, castles, franchises, or from his rights, we will immediately restore them to him. And if a dispute arises over this, then let it be decided by the 25, that's the grand jury, of whom mention is made below in the clause for securing the peace. Moreover, for all those possessions from which anyone has, without the lawful judgment of his peers, been removed by elected servants, will be immediately grant full justice through the trial by jury. 55. The 25 shall secure the peace according to the judgment of the majority. 56, and again, that is the grand jury. 56, if anyone is deprived or removed from lands or liberties or other things without the legal judgment of their peers, the 25, the grand jury, shall immediately restore them, and if a dispute arises over this, then let it be decided by the judgment of his peers, trial by jury, according to the common law. 57. If anyone is deprived of their possessions without the lawful judgment of his peers, we will immediately grant full justice, trial by jury, in accordance with the land, the laws of the land. 60. All of the aforesaid customs and liberties which we, the 25, have ordained in our land as far as pertains to us towards the people shall be observed by all of our elected servants. 61. Moreover, for God and the amendment of our kingdom, and for the better calming of the quarrel that has arisen between us and our elected and appointed stewards, we have ordained all these concessions, desiring that they should enjoy them in complete and firm endurance forever. We give the grant to them the underwritten security, namely, that the 25 who shall be bound by oath to observe and hold and cause to observe peace and liberties. We have granted and confirmed to them by this our present charter, so that if we, or our justices, or our sheriffs, or one of our officers, shall in anything be at fault towards any one, or shall have broken any one of the articles of the peace of this security, and the offenses be notified to four of the aforesaid 25. This is where we came together with the four administrators for each county. We got this out of the paragraph 61 of the Magna Carta. And the offense be notified to the four, that's the four administrators, of the aforesaid 25. The said four shall repair to us, and, laying the transgression before us, petition to have that transgression redressed without delay. So if they can't fix the problem, they bring it to the grand jury. If the grand jury can't fix the problem, or they think there's a crime going on or something of that nature, and they can't fix it, then they send it into the jury. Wherefore, 63, wherefore we ordained and firmly ordered that the church be free, and that the people have and hold all the aforesaid liberties, rights, and concessions, well and peaceably, freely and quietly, fully and wholly, for themselves and their heirs, of us and our heirs, in all respects, in all places, forever, as is aforesaid. An oath, moreover, has been taken, as well on our part as on the act of elected servants, that all these conditions aforesaid shall be kept in good faith and without evil intent. Okay, so that brings us to the end of it. It is kind of short, and it's to the point, just like the Bill of Rights. And again, there were very specific things for that day that I just skipped over and left those paragraphs out. I wanted to focus in to see once how what we can use on our day, because this is the foundation of common law right here. This is the second known paper that I'm aware of anyway. There may be something else I'm not aware of, but this is the second known paper written that is accepted as common law, the first being the Holy Bible. Okay, we will look, I think, at this writ of error. We have time, and it's not all that long either. And people have been asking about how to write a writ of error, so you can get a copy of this on both under the PDF and under the Word, Microsoft Word, up on our website. It's called Writ of Error. Again, it's at nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on Media and come down and you'll see documents, legal documents. Right under legal documents, you'll see PDFs and Word. Writ of Error is the last one on PDF and the last one on Word. Now, I've given it both because some people, well, maybe they just want it in PDF or they can't open Word, and maybe they don't have it, but everyone can open PDF so they can read it and should be able to cut and paste out of that. The problem with PDF cutting and pasting, you won't be able to drag the footnotes. So that's why I put Word up there. If you cut and paste, the footnotes come along with it and set in place, and it's very neat and convenient and helpful to create your own case cutting and pasting. Tonight, by the way, we're going to focus very particularly on talking a little bit about the administrators. I put out a message earlier today that we're going to be announcing something concerning the administrators. We have a little over 300 people that have chosen to become administrators across the nation. We need about 15,000. So people are signing up every day. So people should sign up to become administrators. And it will become, once we get into the courts, those will become full-time jobs. And they will be the shepherds of peace in their county. They will be the ones that will be the investigators of the common law grand jury. And as a prosecutor, so to speak, from a different perspective, of course. The prosecutor comes in with the concerns of a government to go up against the people, whereas from our perspective, we'll be looking at the concerns of the people going up against the government because the government has violated them. And we will be correcting the problems within government offices and agencies, giving them a prescription to make repairs and fix their way, or we will take it before the grand jury for potential indictment. And so if we have a case that we would bring before the grand jury, which I'm sure would be very convincing to them, explaining the violations of the people and the need for them to get involved and to make a decision or send it into the courts. Of course, the grand jury could make a decision and try to remedy the problem as long as they can get both sides to agree. And if they can't, then they send it into the courts and a trial jury will decide. And that's the process of common law. That's the process during Magna Carta. That's the process here in America. But again, they have been destroying that and taking that away from us. And we, of course, are trying to restore that. So one of the things, let me read through this writ of error. Let me just spend a couple of minutes on this first. All those who are coming in and taking the course and checking the box as administrator, and we have hundreds of people who have come in to take the course and have not checked the box as an administrator. If you would like to check the box and change the box to an administrator, you can let us know and we'll help you change that so that you can become an administrator. Now, all administrators, no one is going to be allowed into the position unless we become educated, because that's a wrongdoing. We can't allow people who are ignorant on common law and the process and certain things and principles and take an avow of principles. We can't just allow anyone to come in and just do whatever they want. They can cause as much problem and havoc as the government does. But the way we've set it up, which is four administrators in every county, each of us taking a vow, particularly focusing that we promise to have a sense and a focus and a sense of honor, justice, and mercy in everything that we do, every decision that we make. And we are bound to hold each other to that. And if three see that one is not being held up to that, then we have to fix that. We have to advise them that they are breaking their vow and they need to repent and get back on the road here, or they got to go. And the three can't kick one out. Of course, there is an appellate system that we're setting up. If someone is kicked out of being administrated by the other three for violating their oath, for instance, particularly is the only reason you would do that, they can appeal, and they can appeal to the county next door, who those four sureties of peace would then come in and look at the case and consider and either confirm or disaffirm the decision of the three. And this kind of sets up a safety, you know, for this. Since it seems that it's been wisely set up that there are two appellate systems, so there should be a second potential appellate system on this. And so then we can get another county to come in. But generally speaking, at least there is a safety net and we're self-governing ourselves and making sure. Remember, they took the four people coming in to judge the other four, well, the one against the other three in another county. They took the same oath that we all took. And so we should be able to appreciate when someone is violating that oath. Anybody who acts prejudicially, anybody who acts without honor, anybody who is not just, anybody who doesn't consider mercy, these positions are not good for them. You have to establish those mindsets. After all, the king of our courts is God himself. And we sit on the king's bench, so we are the people particularly the administrators of the grand jury, but the grand jury is the king's bench. And the trial jury is the king's bench, which means they represent God. And justice is required, so therefore they are to operate and do all things under the principles that God has set up, honor, justice, and mercy. And with any judgment in those under those three principles, we should get good results and everyone should be able to rest that night because they've done the best they could and they made the right decision. So anyway, we are filling these spots up. And now is the time because I think we're going to be very close. We are very, very close to get back to bringing in refiling in the courts. We have about eight papers already to be filed. We're going to be filing one at a time. Every 3 or 4 days we're going to file one. They're going to be filed in all 94 federal courts so that they won't be able to expunge it. And we will be serving about 40,000 oath takers, somewhere between 30 and 40,000. The number's not in yet, but we'll know soon. Somewhere between 30 to 40,000 oath takers will be served. So the whole nation will be aware of this. And there's some other things that we'll talk about that really puts it out even further than that. We'll talk about that once we start filing. And so these filings of these papers are really, you know, the pressure points to make our out of control. You know, again, there's nothing wrong with the government. It's the people who have taken positions and seat in our government that have violated their oaths, that have violated their authority and their jurisdiction. And we are suffering from that. And that's what we're here to fix, is to bring justice back into our political and judicial realms and require obedience of the law. Because right now, they all are in bad behavior. In order for them to continue in their office, they must return to good behavior. Good behavior is obeying the law of the land. The law of the land is the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, common law. That's the law of the land. But anyway, these positions, going back to the positions, these four administrators, absolute requirement that people take the civics course. So if you, anybody who is not, that would like to become an administrator, just go up and click on, go to National Liberty Alliance and click on civics course, join the course, take the course, get through that. That's part one that people, all administrators must do. Anybody that's already taken the administrator's course and didn't check the box, I'm not sure whether there's a way for you. I'll have to check to see. If there is, I'll tell you next week if there's a way that you can fix that yourself. But if not, we'll tell you in a few minutes on how you can get a hold of us, and we'll check the box for you, which will put you into that category. That'll put you on a special mailing list of administrators only, and you'll get certain information and reports or meetings that you may attend that other people won't be attending. The second, we're doing a second course now, which is really a course of paperwork. We wrote a writ of habeas corpus, which we're getting ready to serve in the federal courts. But we wrote one in a framework. We built off of Bill Thornton's work. He already created a habeas corpus, very well done. He laid out the principles of it. And so we worked off of his structure, and we put a lot of our own stuff in there, but we have a lot of his stuff in there too. So together it's a very powerful paper, I think. And once we file that habeas corpus, we will read it online. You know, we'll read it on a Monday night, and we'll discuss it, and we'll explain and show the unbelievable power of habeas corpus. They've been trying to silence habeas corpus for a very, very long time. As a matter of fact, they've been trying to shut it down for over 1,000 years, ultimately. That is tyrants. Tyrants don't like habeas corpus because it takes control away from them. And so we'll get into that discussion maybe in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll be able to really go through that and digest it very well. But we will be teaching a course, which will be a live course. I'm not sure exactly when it'll start. It's possible it might start this week if we can put it the beginning of the course together in time. But if not, it'll be next week, probably a Wednesday night is what we're looking for possibly. And that particular course, we're going to start off, as I mentioned, with the framework of habeas corpus, how to write one for the federal court coming out of a state court, or how to write one for the federal court coming out of a federal court. And the one we're going to be writing very soon is in a federal court, and it's going to be filing the habeas corpus in a different jurisdiction of the federal court. The jurisdiction that is holding this individual is under the jurisdiction of equity, which brings them under the rules of chancery, where no justice is ever found. We are moving it into a court of in a court of law, which operates according to the rules of common law. And again, like I said, it's very powerful. As a matter of fact, the original, and I think we'll be reading this in this paper here. No, it won't be in this paper, but when we get into the habeas corpus, we will find the wording here that talks about when the first habeas corpus really came about, and the purpose of what they brought it about and what it actually became, and really started to use it. And the purpose of the habeas corpus is to do exactly this, to remove us out of foreign courts and back into our own courts of record, which are common law courts. And again, very powerful. The judiciary of the United States is already set up on autopilot. No one can steer it a different direction. It has a process, a procedure of law in it. And once you push that ball going down the road, so to speak, it must go through the process and execute and exercise the judicial process along the way to its end. And its end is to free that individual. And anybody who tries to stop it would be in violation of the law, and it would be a pretty dangerous thing for them to try to do, to unrighteously step in the middle and try to sidestep or shortchange the writ of habeas corpus. Okay, so we will talk a little more later on about that, but that's going to be the first part of the course, is how to write habeas corpus from both perspectives. And then there is lots of other papers. You know, people need to understand and know how to write true bills. And also we need to understand how we have to get an orientation ourselves. So we're going to have an orientation course, which is pretty much most of what you already taken place in the civics course. But we'll do something really that kind of ties it all together. We also, as administrators, will be responsible for providing for an orientation for all jurors, whether they're a trial jury or a grand jury. Which means we get 6 to 8 hours with them the first day they come in, and we give them an orientation. We want to be absolutely very careful not to persuade a jury this way or that way, but just to give them the tools, the principles necessary to understand and realize that they're sitting on the king's bench, and the king is not going to tolerate anybody being unjust on that bench. And they will take an oath that they will be obedient and execute and exercise the will of the king, which is God, which brings us to common law, because that's what common law is all about, justice in our courts. Okay, I think I could do this in probably 20 minutes or less, maybe 20 minutes or less. Recently we filed a paper in the federal court, and it was kicked out by the clerk. Now, we knew the clerk on their own did not kick this out. We knew that there was a judge behind them. So we wrote a paper, and the reason they kicked us out was because we didn't pay their $400. We're not going to pay their $400. You pay their $400, you're in their jurisdiction. So we're not going to pay it. So we filed the papers, and the clerk kicked it out, even though we warned the clerk. The clerk took a few days to make that decision. Obviously, they were consulting with the judge and says, just send that back. So they sent it back. Now, I don't know whether they read the papers or not. I got to believe that they did. They took a pretty big chance, so we sued the clerk. And we sent the papers back with a filing of a court case against the clerk for violating our right of due process and requiring that we pay money to get into our courts. Well, within 2 or 3 days, we got the paper, our original papers, filed back, stamped, and going through. So we kind of laid that aside, because we're not after the clerk anyway. So we kind of laid that aside. A few days later, we got a letter. I'm going to read that letter. It comes from a judge, a chief judge, female judge down in New York City. And I'm going to read the letter, and she puts it in a form, it is called an order directing payment of the fee, or fill out a poor man's application, and if we don't do it in 30 days, they're going to throw our case out and you're not let it go forward. Now, the other side has already defaulted on this case, by the way. We have filed through common law, so we filed our own summons to all parties involved, which is something we'll teach people later on. But right now, let's look at this here, this writ of error. So this judge writes this paper back, makes an order, and we respond with a writ of error. Here's the paper that she wrote. Okay. Chief Judge of the United States District Court. Plaintiff brings action pro se. Within 30 days of the date of this order, plaintiff must either pay the $400 in fee that are required to file a civil action in this court, or submit a fully completed and signed request to proceed in form of pauperis, which is really as a pauper, or a poor man. That is, without prepayment of fees, To proceed with civil action in this court, a plaintiff must either pay the $400 fee, which is $350 filing fee plus $50 administrative fee. Wonder who gets that money. Or to request authorization to proceed without payment of the fee, submit a signed IFP application, which was attached. And then they give us the U.S. Codes 28, subsection 1914 and 1915. Plaintiffs submitted the complaints without the filing fees or an IFP application. Within 30 days of the date of this order, plaintiff must either pay the $400 or fee or submit the attached IFP application. She seems to be repeating herself, but anyway. If plaintiff submits the IFP application, it should be labeled with docket number 15CV2188, LAP. But by the way, let me just mention again, there's a copy of this writ of error up on nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on media and look under the legal papers here. Now, if you open up the PDF one, you will see the letter from the judge. We didn't put it in Word because this is in PDF. It's not in Word, so we don't have it in Word. All right. If the court grants the application, plaintiff will be permitted to proceed without prepayment of fees. Isn't that nice? They're going to give us permission to proceed in our own courts, that we are ownership of those courthouses. The clerk of the court is directed to assign this matter to my docket and mail a copy of this order to the plaintiff and note service on the docket. The summons shall issue at this time. Now, no summons shall issue at this time. In federal court, when you file in a federal court, if you go to a state court, you go down, you write up the summons, and you take it down, and once you file all your papers, they stamp that summons. Okay, once they stamp that summons with their file number, now you take it and you serve it on the people, and now they have to be summoned into court. That's the process. Without the summons, they haven't really been called. In federal court, when you file the papers, they make their own summons up and they summons the people, although we file and serve the papers and we let them know that it's been served. Now, we've already served the papers, but we went one step further than that. We served the summons because under common law, that's the process. So we sealed our own papers and we served the summons, and that's already been given to the courts. Now, they're saying that no summons shall issue at this time. We're going to let them know we've already issued that summons, and in a couple of days, matter of fact, we're going to write another paper of default because they've already defaulted. If plaintiff complies with the order, the case shall proceed in accordance with the procedures of the clerk's office. I'm not interested in this procedures of the clerk's office because they proceed according to the chancery. If plaintiff fails to comply with this order within the time allowed, the actions will be dismissed. The court certifies under, again, USC 28, 1915, that any appeal from the order would not be taken in good faith, and therefore in forma pauperis status is denied for the purpose of an appeal. Now, that was kind of confusing, but basically is what we wouldn't be able to appeal for the pauper status. But we would be able to refile, of course. We just wouldn't be able to come in with pauper status. So I'm not interested in paying either way or not paying their way. They need to just take the papers. Anyway, holding that appellant demonstrates good faith when seeking review of a non-frivolous issue. So they're calling our issue frivolous, our action frivolous. All right, so here is the response. And this is going out maybe tomorrow or the next day. It hasn't even gone out yet, but it's going out. But again, for the purpose of teaching people how to write a writ of error, we did it this way on this for this particular purpose. Of course, whatever the reason you're writing a writ of error for, you would use those facts in this writ of error. But the structure and the framework of a writ of error is the same. And that's what this is all about. Okay, writ of error. The court of record comes now to review the facts, record, and proceeds resulting in rulings dated April 1st, 2015, attached. By the way, I think I mentioned this earlier. This is a combination of work between Bill Thornton, him writing a good part of this, and the structure of this paper, and we taking and adding on that, putting our own focus and a lot of, our own focus in on it, and of course, our own facts in this particular case. The record shows that this court of record held a hearing on April 1, 2015. Contrary to the rules of common law, proceeding according to the principles of the method and procedures adopted by the Court of Chancery, for the purpose for changing jurisdiction from common law to equity, which proceeds under the rules of Chancery, citing 28 U.S.C. 1914 and 1915, statutes repugnant to the Constitution, as its authority that extorts filthy lucre, which perverts judgment. Under threat to unlawfully dismiss plaintiff's action, thereby denying plaintiff's unalienable rights of due process by dismissing a court of record, or pay the extortion fee for a jurisdiction that produces the same results, dismissing the plaintiff's court of record, and denies plaintiff's unalienable right of due process. Now, again, in this paper, there is lots of footnotes, and people should study this if they're going to use a paper like this and go through this very carefully to understand, because there's some really heavy points in this paper, and they're really expressed deeply inside these footnotes. Furthermore, even under the Court of Equity's own laws that says court ignores, 28 U.S.C. has no force because it lacks regulations. Now, we put a footnote in you, and I'm going to read this particular footnote, which statutes without regulations have no force. Now, we put a note up on our page, as a matter of fact, under where these documents are concerning this point, because it's a very, very powerful point, and it's U.S. versus Merksey. You'll find a paper on that that just talks about this. Statutes without regulations have no force. Here the statute is not complete by itself, since it merely declares the range of the operation and leaves it to progeny the means to be utilized in the effectuation of its command. But it is the statute that creates the offense of the willful removal of the labels of origin and provides the punishment for violations. The regulations, on the other hand, prescribes the identifying language of the label itself, tags to the respective geographical area. Once promulgated, these regulations called for by the statutes itself have the force of law, and violation thereof incur criminal prosecution, just as if all the details had been incorporated into the congressional language. The results is that neither the statute nor the regulation are complete without the other. Now, this is extremely important because all of U.S. 28 has no regulations. And they've been treating this like with law as long as I've been in the courts. I didn't realize this until a little while back when someone showed me this case. And it's very important. You don't have to argue against these points because they're not law. They're not even law in their own courts. But anyway, the result is that neither the statute nor the regulation are complete without the other. The only together do they have any force. In effect, therefore, the construction of one necessarily involves the construction of the other. It's not law. Can't be used, not even in their own court. Okay, back into this paper here. Okay, so Magistrate Loretta Priesca, acting under the color of law as judge at the hearing, contrary to the common law, with neither the plaintiff or the defendants present. Now remember, what is the judge doing looking into paperwork coming into the court? And, you know, there's been no exchange or anything between the plaintiff and the defendant. And what brought them to look at these papers? That in itself is a violation of law. And the judge is not to be just to decide, oh, I'm going to take this case. No, judges are picked out of a pool, okay? But judges don't get to decide what cases they're going to have and what cases they're not going to have. Their name is pulled out of a pool, and they get this case and so on. The next one gets the next one and so on. Any violation of that is a violation of law, because remember, they are jurists, and we, the people, are supposed to be picked out of a pool as jurists. As a matter of fact, they don't do that either. Okay, the records show that the magistrate, on her own authority, conducted a hearing in accordance with the rules of Chancery and not law. thereby trespassing on the case. The magistrate conducted her own court without notice or concurrence of the parties and without due process. The magistrate, presuming to be the owner of the courtroom, not satisfied with the lawful rules of the court, she became a loose cannon and imposed rules of another jurisdiction foreign to this court. The position and pursuits of the plaintiff is not frivolous and is hereby rebutted. Generally, frivolous is relatively defined as a claim or defense is frivolous if a proponent can present no rational argument based upon the evidence of law in support of that claim or defense. Contrary to Magistrate Loretta's presumption, a plaintiff does not seek to proceed in forma pauperis, which proceeds according to the rules of chancery, nor will plaintiff accept an exchange of filthy lucre for prejudicial justice in a court of chancery. Plaintiff has opened a court of record, see action at law, which proceeds under the rules of common law without costs. The United States Supreme Court has ruled that a natural man or woman is entitled to relief for free access to its judicial tribunals and public offices in every state in the Union. And that was Crandell versus Nevada, been held up in some other cases. A plaintiff should not be charged a fee or cost for the lawful and constitutional right to petition this court in this manner in which he is entitled to relief, as it appears that the filing fee rule was originally implemented for fiction and subjects of the states and should not be applied to the plaintiff, who is a natural individual and entitled to relief. That's Hale versus Henkel. That's a very important ruling here because it reveals what's really going on here. You see, if you go pay that fee, you now just walked into their jurisdiction, didn't you? You paid that fee because common law, you don't pay a fee. You pay fee in the equity courts to bring you into their courts. And like justice said here in the U.S. Supreme Court, the filing fee was originally implemented for fiction. That's corporations. And subjects, I'm not a subject, I'm one of the people, of the state. As a matter of fact, the subjects of the state actually are those people, the elected and appointed individuals. They are subject to the state when they're in that legal capacity, okay? So let's move on. Plaintiff is neither fiction nor a subject, as is an elected or an appointed official owing allegiance to the sovereign people of the 50 United States. Plaintiff is one of the people of New York, subject to no laws except those prescribed by nature. Rights indirectly denied, constitutional rights, would be of little value if they could be indirectly denied. Gomillion versus Lightfoot. There can be no sanction or penalty imposed upon one because of the exercise of a constitutional right. Shura versus Cullen. No state shall convert a liberty, it's our right. No state can convert a liberty into a license and charge a fee thereof. Modoc versus Pennsylvania. If the state converts a right or liberty into a privilege, the citizen can ignore the license and fee and engage in the right liberally with impunity. Shuttlesworth versus City of Birmingham, Alabama. American jurisprudence. This is constitutional law, subsection 326, free justice and open courts. And this was derived from the Magna Carta. Remedy for all injuries in most of the state's constitutions, there are provisions varying slightly in terms which stipulate that justice shall be administered to all without delay or denial, without sale or prejudice, and that the court shall always be open to all alike. These provisions are based largely upon the Magna Carta, Chapter 40, which provides, we will sell to no man. We will sell no justice. We will sell justice to no man. That's in the Magna Carta. And again, we read that in the Magna Carta. And again, here is a reference by American Jurisprudence. And American Jurisprudence is a book of collection of law of the rulings of the United States Supreme Court and laying out the jurisprudence to be obeyed by every judge. So here, right in their own book, their handbook, the book that tells them what they can do and what they can't do, they are told that they cannot require money for justice. We will sell to no man. We will not deny to any man either justice or right. The chief purpose of the Magna Carta provision was to forbid the king from selling justice by imposing fees on litigants, sound familiar, though his courts, and to deal a death blow to the attendant venal and disgraceful practices of a corrupt judiciary in demanding oppressive gratitudes for giving or withholding decisions in pending causes. It has been appropriately said that in a free government, the doors of litigation are always wide open and must constantly remain so. The extent of the constitutional provision has been regarded as broader than the original confines of the Magna Carta, and such constitutional provisions have been held to forbid the selling of justice, not merely by magistrates, but by the state itself. Therefore, denial of access into the People's Court of Justice for refusing to pay a fee would be a violation of plaintiff's unalienable rights of due process protected under the Fifth Amendment. Furthermore, plaintiff does not bring this action pro se. It is in the process. It is in process under fiction, but in pro per. Most legal dictionaries define the term pro se as someone who represents themselves. Black Law Fourth Edition defines it in person, in pro per. Therefore, we use the term in pro per. In that capacity, we accept the term pro se, not to be confused with one responding their representing their fiction, whereby the jurisdictional fraud might be assumed and status applied as a subject. Without proper authority, the magistrate stepped out of her functions as a magistrate, and by her actions and statements figuratively assumed the cloak of a tribunal. The genius of a court of record is not to be undermined. It is the birthright of every American to settle issues in a court of record if he so chooses. Throughout the order, the record shows that the rules of the court were not followed, that the magistrate attempted to function as a tribunal, that the court was ineffective in furthering the goal of justice for all. These failures to follow the prescribed procedures are sufficiently disruptive to the goal of providing fair justice that the court finds it necessary to issue a writ error quo quorum nobis residant as follows. The court, having reviewed the facts, and that, by the way, is in the name of the king. The court, having reviewed the facts, the record, and the process by which the ruling was issued, and finding that the magistrate rendered a ruling by applying rules from jurisdictions foreign to this court without leave of court, and finding that the orderly decorum of the court was replaced by defective improper process and usurpation of legislative and court powers without leave of court. Magistrate Loretta Peresca has mistaken the filing of an action at law in a court of record under the rules of common law for a complaint in a court not of record under the rules of chancery. Magistrate Loretta Peresca is now fully informed of her error. Now, we're not looking to sue her. She needs to let this paperwork go forward. Of course, if she continues to stop it, she's now been informed. She has violated our Fifth Amendment right, and we're going to have to deal with that. Anyway, now, therefore, the court issues this writ of error, quo quorum nobis resident, to wit. The court rescinds the ruling entered April 1st, 2015. Take note, summons has already issued, March 12, 2015. See attached under the rules of common law as a private individual. Henceforth, the writ, which is called precipice, shall not be served on anyone for the holding so as to cause a free man to lose his court. Magna Carta, Article 34. And then, of course, dated in this county and so on and so forth. Okay, that's the end of it. It's a total of 5 pages. And again, any error in the court that you want to write, you use this framework, but basically put your own facts in there, the own situation, whatever's going on, and attach the necessary papers of their ruling if you have that. Sometimes it's an oral ruling and you want to get to it before they make a written ruling. And if you took good notes, you can then write your writ of error prior to even getting their ruling out in writing. Often they take days, sometimes 30, 40, 50, 60 days to get their ruling written out. So you don't want to wait, really. Okay, that brings us to the end of that, those two papers. Let me see where we're at here. Gerard, do you have anything to add here or to announce before we open up the phones? Gary, Robert, do you have anything to announce before we open up the phones? And also, Sheila and Eric, or anybody in any of the committees or directors, if you have anything you want to announce, only 1 minute. You know, we don't want to spend 20 minutes on the mic. 1 minute, and you can refer that people to where they can get more information. I'm going to open up the Q&A, but the only people into the Q&A right now are directors of committees or group leaders into the queue if they have an announcement or a point to make. Gerard and Gary and Robert, you're already open, so if you don't have nothing to say, we're going to move on. Okay, I don't see anyone coming into the queue, so we're going to ask for anybody that is new, been visiting us for a week or two or three, and let's let those people into the queue first if they have any questions. Star 6 to get into the queue. Anybody that is new that has a question, we'll take those people first. Star 6 to get into the queue. And in about a minute or two, others that want to get into the queue can get into the queue. Star 6. Okay, we have a couple people coming into the queue. Okay, first caller. Gerard, are you here, by the way? First caller, 267-423. Give us your first name and your state, and maybe someone out there can put names next to these people as they're talking. 267, go right ahead. What's your first name and your state?
Florence Mason. Oh, that's my first name is Florence. I'm sorry.
How you
the
doing,
state
Florence?
Is Pennsylvania. How are you?
Florence from Pennsylvania. Good.
I'm a little bit behind everything. I came in a little late. I had trouble getting on. So I'm kind of like not really up to date on the whole issue behind the court process of what you guys are doing. I kind of just wanted to ask a question about the law clerk and if you're familiar with what to do when the clerk and the judge has concluded together in the federal court to falsify or keep a document off the record for over 8 months. Who do you report that to?
Well, unfortunately, there's no one to report it to because you're only reporting it to the fox in charge of the hen house. We never see any. Well, occasionally you do get justice. You do get someone. I don't know how long they last in the system because they get rid of them because they're interested in justice and not making money. But there are ways to deal with this, and you have to learn the process and the procedures of the court. You have to learn common law. You have to learn how to maintain your jurisdiction and to turn on a steamroller as soon as they violate your unalienable right. The right that they always violate, the very first right that they violate, and they do it all the time, is your Fifth Amendment right of due process. They always do that. The moment they move you to another court, they violated your right of due process. The moment they deny you services, they violated your right of due process. The moment they remove something from the file, they violated your right of due process. So you have to understand that you have to remove these people from the bench and from the control of your paperwork. And the only way you can do that is to sue them in a federal court for violating your right of due process. So that's the process and procedure to first go forward to remove them people. And now you have two court cases going, the one that you're in and the other one that you just removed these people out of into another court, then you're going to sue them for whatever funds you think it's for. But that's how you do it. But it takes knowledge. You have to learn how to write papers and how to do these things.
Well, okay, I'm familiar with writing papers and things of that nature. I'm not a novelist at it. What I'm trying to say is, okay, we're talking about this is not like an issue from a state court. This is at the federal level already. So you're saying that you want to file charges in the federal court still?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Because once they understand that you're a no-nonsense person and you're putting them onto the record and onto the paper and you're going after them for $25,000, I go for $25,000 each incident for each person involved, and I sue everybody, the lawyers, it makes it a conspiracy too. Once they understand that you're a no-nonsense person and you're not going to take this guy, they start to get worried about it, you know, because now they got to have a new judge coming into the court that they just were pulled out of because they're now removed from the bench. They can't stay in the other court case. That judge already knows what you've done to the other judge. You got him worried or her worried, and they better be worried because you're going to add them to the court case as quick as you took them out. You'll do the same thing. You want justice in the court. You're coming into your court to get justice, and that's the purpose. And if you're not going to get that justice in that court, then you're going to take those people out and have them replaced with someone who will eventually give you justice, whether they want to or not. Now, removing papers from the courthouse is a constant problem. It's a plague everywhere. We see it all the time. We've had so many cases we've watched this happen to. That is why we, on coming in from the perspective of the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, a national movement from every state of the union, that's why we file in all 94 federal district courts. They're not going to be able to expunge in all the courts. Plus, we also file it to all of the oath takers. But, of course, you can't do anything like that. That becomes very expensive, very involved, and that's not the way the process works either. No one should really be doing that. Only because of extraordinary situations and circumstances are we doing that, and we have chosen to do that from the perspective of a grand jury, which gives us a lot more authority and clout in the courts than coming in as one of the people. We're coming in as the people in a whole, those who have ordained and established this Constitution for them, and we're in there to get obedience. And that's how we're coming into the court, from that perspective. And that brings us right into a court of record. Now, the fiction court, which is what you're in, you don't realize it maybe, or maybe you do realize it, you're in a fictional court. They are operating under the rules of chancery, and they are going to violate you, and you're never going to get your case won. They don't want the people to win, especially if you're representing yourself. They're angry with you because you're coming in without a lawyer. Like, who do you think you are that you think you can come into your own court that you own and think you can come tell us what to do? You know, that's their attitude. And the answer to that, of course, is yes. And that's why you have to let them know that you're not going to give them deal with any of their nonsense.
Okay,
but hang on, Gerard,
now,
you wanted to say something here? Hang on.
Yeah, I just wanted real quick. We had a retired judge that was on here a couple weeks ago, and he said, definitely file a complaint with the judicial board, the oversight board. And I told him I had done that, and it didn't seem like anything happened. He said they don't like to get those complaints. He said, but remember, if something's going on in the court, you have to put it on the record. He said, because when that judicial oversight board goes in and looks at the transcript, they don't see anything. So it's your job when the judge, the clerk, whoever, it's your job to pipe up and say, let the record show that the judge is not putting the paper in. Let the record show that the judge refuses to answer. Let the record show that the clerk did this or that. That is on that transcript, which they won't take at all. I mean, it becomes very hard, especially when you have court watchers. But when they go back with your complaint, they see that on the record. And what happens is they assume you're right, and they'll sanction the judge. And they've removed a couple of judges here in the past year or so.
Now, just what you just said, I have my DACA report for my civil rights complaint, and it's 24 pages, okay? And my last couple pages on the docket, because you said making the record, which is absolutely important, but I do something a little bit different as well. I not only make a verbal record, but I also make the record of the docket report, okay? And my docket report says notice of appeal against the erroneous dismissal of, you know, trying to dismiss government actors or employees out of my case without even a hearing. There has been many of case laws that tells them that they do not have a right to do that, but this judge does it anyway on a constant basis. Then I had on there where
the
judge...
Do you know why they're doing that?
No, you can tell me.
Go ahead. By what authority they do that?
Well, under what authority?
They're doing it by their own authority as the king of the court under chancery. You see, look, you're in a chancery court. As soon as I start... Look, the fact of the matter is everyone that goes to court is in a chancery court. You got to get out of that jurisdiction. That's hard to do, but it's really not too hard to do. You got to really, you know, keep pushing it. But the bottom line is they keep dragging you back into this chancery court. And once they get you into a chancery court, they're operating off of legislation, Okay? And when the legislation becomes wishy-washy, they're able to be the kings of the court and just make it up as they go, and they do it. And the legislation that they work off under the rules of chancery, okay, allows them to go in opposition to the Constitution, because there's legislation out there that has done away with the Constitution for the purpose of these courts. And that's what you're battling, and that's what you're up against. And they know what's going on. They understand this. But the people going into the courts don't understand it, and I think a lot of lawyers don't understand it either. Certainly the state lawyers don't, but some of the federal lawyers probably do. But that's the problem you have to deal with. And once you understand that there's two jurisdictions, and you have to read the paperwork very carefully, say, ah, look at this, they're pushing me back into the jurisdiction. I object, Your Honor. You see, you have to object to it and push them back. You got to let them know, I see what you're doing. And you got to put it onto the paper, but you always got to try to give them a way out, okay? Because mm-hmm. you don't want to put them into a corner. There's nothing worse than a rat in a corner, and these people are rats. So you don't want to put them in a corner. It does get to the point when they're not getting a hint, then you put it to them straight out, and now you've damaged him in his papers, and he's going to be upset about that, because how's he going to get this out once you're revealing it, and then you tie him into another court, and then he's pulled off that bench? I mean, it's a problem for this guy.
Okay, so if we report him to another court, now that's going to the higher level, whether it be the third circuit or whatever. But when you go to file a case against the clerk and the judge for these violations or tampering with the records, wouldn't that be in the federal claims court?
Well, again, when you use the word claims, I'm not too sure what that means. But if it's in the federal district court, that's where you're filing, yes. That would be the proper place. Remember, that judge and that clerk can't touch that paper when you file something against them. You have to notify them first and let them know and tell them, don't touch the, you know, don't get back into this case, because you've now been relieved to this case. Now you're filing the papers and you refile everything else and you're going forward. Again, it's a hassle. It's an uphill battle, but it's a process that you have to keep pushing on.
Okay.
You know? But we don't want to spend too much time on a particular case of this type of thing. But, you know, we've got a lot of paperwork that you can learn from. Go up to nationallibertyalliance.org, and on the media page, right underneath the court filings, you'll see legal documents. There's a lot of stuff in these documents you're going to be able to use in court. Cut and paste, you know, with the footnotes and everything. Powerful, powerful statements, U.S. Supreme Court rulings, even U.S. codes that assist us, Constitution, Magna Carta, the Holy Bible, everything's in here, Bill of Rights, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next caller, Regina, is it? 816? By the way, Q&A is open. Anybody wants to get into the Q&A, *6 to get into the Q&A. Regina.
My name is Cheryl Dean.
Cheryl Dean. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, it says Regina on the phone, but go right ahead.
Okay. I'm nervous. My first time. The judge, I sent my granddaughter to the hospital because she was cutting herself because she missed her mom. And a week later, I never met the doctor. He called the hotline. She's been in the custody for over a year and a half. They won't let me see her, talk to her.
Yeah. Well, they kidnapped her is what they did. Okay. They violated yours and your granddaughter's. The granddaughter's? Is that who it is?
Yes.
The granddaughter? They violated your granddaughter's right of due process. They violated your right of due process. It's a slam dunk case. Case is over. You win it very quickly if you know how to handle the jurisdiction and handle the case.
Almost. I told it to the attorneys, which they are no longer on my case.
Yeah, look, they're complicit. All those lawyers are complicit. They're making money off you by going through the courts over and over again.
My granddaughter, though, and as we speak right now, they have not charged me, and it's been almost a year and a half. They won't let me talk to her, see her. She looks like a zombie. She had planned to go to
Have you just found us? Are you recent with us? You just found
my
us.
My first time, and they're killing my granddaughter as we speak. She's been. They're giving her 17 pills. They let her take it. on her own recently, and she's been in the hospital. They don't tell me anything. The judges don't tell me nothing. The lawyers don't tell me nothing. And in July, the judge told me that we will be sending her somewhere. They excluded her father. She had never seen him. They have done everything you can imagine to my granddaughter. She looks like a wounded puppy. They broke
her. All right, well, look, let me. I just unmuted Gina from New Jersey. She's the director for the CPS, lawsuit that we're working out. Gina, are you there?
I'm here, John.
Okay. All right, maybe you can give this lady some information, and she could tie into your meetings and, you know, work with her, and maybe she might want to join the court case that we're opening up on a joint effort.
Did she take my number and give me a call?
Yeah, give her your number, Gina.
Okay, 732.
Yeah, hold on a minute. She's going to get a paper.
I got a pencil. I got a paper. Her name is Gina.
Gina,
yes.
Give Gina a call. Go ahead. Give her your number.
Okay,
732-642-0261.
Yes, let me give you another number. 732-642-0261.
Yes. Okay, the other number?
732-455-5080. Right. If you don't get me on one, you'll get me on the other one.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, Gina is the direct. Go ahead. You want to repeat that number again? Go ahead.
732-455-5080.
Yes, that's it.
Okay
now
right
Gina
now.
Is the director of the our we have a lawsuit going up against the CPS and the APS and the juvenile court and all that stuff, and we're going to be doing habeas corpuses to get all these children back. And if you want to become part of that, talk with Gina. She'll let you know what's going on, and you can they have meetings once a week.
They're giving it over 2,000 milligrams of medicine every day.
Yeah, we're going to help you stop that as soon as we can. We're trying to get it. We have to really organize the lawsuit first, and we're going to be getting into the courts as soon as possible. And so you want to talk with Gina, and you'll work it out with that. Now, Gina, what are you guys having meetings on Sundays at this point?
Yes, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Okay, so Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when you talk with Gina. And anybody else that has this kind of a problem, hopefully you wrote the phone number down for Gina, and you can call her tomorrow or as soon as you can, and get involved into the plan that we have. Now, we're not going to have a Wednesday meeting. I heard someone before the meetings mention something about a Wednesday meeting. There is no Wednesday meeting this week. Right now, the only CPS meeting is what's going on Sundays, and it's run by Gina and Sheila. Now, when we need to, we will have a meeting, and we'll do it on a Wednesday, but right now we don't need to do one. And anybody who is coming new to this stuff, again, should get out to nationallibertyalliance.org. If you click on the group, we'll go to the groups, you highlight groups, and you click on your CPS Joint Action Lawsuit. Okay, you click on that. There's information there. There's phone numbers there. Mm-hmm. And also there is recordings of our past meetings, okay? We've had 3 meetings that were recorded, and then now Gina is running meetings on Sundays, so they'll be weekly. And we'll be encouraging people to do meetings within their state and other things. So, but we'll work that out as we go.
Okay. On
Gina,
Sunday,
did you want to say
fine.
Anything else to her?
Yes. Call me tomorrow because
Sunday.
I want to... This meeting here,
like
call me right after this
tonight.
Meeting is over. I'll still be up.
I can't hear you.
Yeah, try it again, Gina.
No, I'm saying she can call me tomorrow morning or after this meeting is done.
Okay.
But I think she's trying to call me now, but I didn't want to miss out on the rest of this meeting.
Right, yeah, if you want to call her tonight, wait till midnight in Eastern time. You're in Pennsylvania anyway, so you're in the same time zone.
I'm in Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh, you're in Kansas City. Okay, so you're in a different time zone. You're on what? Central. You're an hour different. So call her at 11 o'clock tonight, your time, and you'll be able to talk to her.
It's 9:21 now.
Right, for us it's 10:21.
Okay, yeah, well, it's 10:21. Now, on Sundays, what time do I call her? I guess I
can
call
her. Well, she'll give you all the information on the phone.
I'll give her all the information when I call her.
I'm going to call you when this is over.
Okay.
Right. What was your first name again?
Geraldine, like Geraldine.
Geraldine. Okay, Geraldine. Thanks for the call.
All right, Geraldine. I'll be talking to you.
Okay, Gina.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Gina, I'm going to leave you unmuted for right now. Just make sure you mute your mic so we don't hear any background noise. In case we need you again, you can pipe in. Okay, we have a 785 number calling in, 412. Go right ahead.
Yes, John. This is John R. out of Kansas, Central Kansas.
Hi,
I've
John.
Got a question for you. I just discovered this. I guess it's kind of a vague question, but... is my understanding that any warrant that's issued by a public official, isn't it supposed to be backed up by a signed document from a judge?
What are they doing?
A warrant. Absolutely, it has to have a wet ink signature on it.
And an affidavit,
a sworn affidavit, which they never do.
Even on an arrest by the grand jury, even if the grand jury indicts you, the judge has to send out the warrant, and the judge must put a wet ink signature on it and attach the affidavit. Now, the affidavit is whatever affidavits that they gave, which is proof, to the jury. The problem is they never do affidavits, so they don't have a case, and that's because they're not operating according to law. They're operating according to equity through chancery, rules of chancery, and that's why they're getting away with it. If you call them on that and understand how to deal with that, you'll get the upper hand.
Okay, well... also, I've received one quite a while back, and it was in a different procedure, but it was sent to me from the Sheriff's Department by mail, and there's no backing of that. I went and researched it. There's no backing of that in the court office of a judge signing the permission for them to issue a warrant.
All right, so there really is no warrant, but you got to be careful because these people will do what they please anyway. So you got to be careful with that, you know. And what I would do is think about how you might approach this, but to open up a case in the federal court for violating your unalienable rights, they're assaulting you ultimately, filing warrants without the due process and frightening you and threatening you, because that's what all these things are doing. You know, so that's what you could do to stop this whole thing and catch it before it gets out of hand.
I understand. And now I hate to ask you more than one more question about it, but another question is I've got not just a few, but I've got quadruple. I mean, I probably count 60 different things that they're doing. The only thing I'm concerned when I start filing these with the federal court, then they're going to start saying that I'm filing fraudulent court cases.
Yeah, well, they try to do that. They call it frivolous, but again, they've tried to do that to us. They haven't really put it too far with us, and I think that's because they're worried about our paperwork. But now that, you know, they don't... I just got that in a letter that we're being frivolous. I mean, excuse me, frivolous? You know, if I can't logically back up and show law of my point, then I'm being frivolous. But you know what? You're not showing me any law or any law that has any kind of weight. You're the one being frivolous. And I've got piles and piles of U.S. Supreme Court rulings, law, American jurisprudence, I mean, everything. So, yeah, that's a word they throw around a lot. They try to make you a little worried. But again, you got to really be careful when you go into the courts, and you got to really understand how to deal with them. So you got to learn. And again, work with NLA to get this to the other side of things, where we'll have back courts of law and not courts of equity, and then you won't have these problems, because that's the key. And by the way, everybody that is listening to this program, whether it's live or whether you're listening over the radio at a later time or downloading the audio off of our website, everybody needs to get to nationallibertyalliance.org. You need to go up to our groups and get involved, okay? You need to get involved with the Courtroom Observers Group or the media group. We also have different committees. If you go under the directory, will be a list of committees, which we'll be putting them under the groups too, but there's different committees. Everybody should be involved. Go out and see what kind of a committee you might want to get into, assist and work and help. Look at, because only the people can save the nation. And if you don't get up to do it, who's going to do it? And so that's what this is all about. This is, you know, we are proactive. If you want to get your rights back because they've taken it away from us, and you or you want to be able to walk into a court and be heard and have a real law applied, well, get together with us. Join up and get active. Okay, so look at the different committees we have going, look at the groups we have going, get involved, take our civics course, become an administrator maybe, which is a paid job in the near future as soon as we get into the courts, and just get involved, because again, only the people can do this. Before we take our next question, though, thanks for calling. What was your first name?
This is John R. out of Central Kansas.
Hey, John. Thanks for calling, and, you know, bone up as best you can off of our website, continue to learn, and get involved. Join the committees. Join, get involved in some way or another. Help us get the word out. So
I am. Thank you for your help.
Thank you. Okay, before we take the next caller, I do have a question that was asked on by email, and after I answer this question, Gerard, maybe you might want to take the phones, but let me see if I can find it here. Was the top piece of paper, which of course is no longer the top piece of paper. Okay, here it is. Okay, Richard from New Hampshire. I don't know whether he asked this last week, whether we got this last week. I think we just got it and we're looking at it this week. But if we're repeating ourselves, I guess we are. He asked, if it's possible, could you explain the difference between the petite grand jury and the common law grand jury and how it relates to the constitutional language? Now, there's two different juries. There's the petite and then there's the grand jury. The petite jury is the trial jury. The grand jury is the grand jury. Now, the difference between the what would you call it, the equity juries and the common law grand juries is one is law and one is fiction. And so all of these grand juries that are out there right now that are under the equity courts, they're all illegal. And they're not doing anything according to law. And so we're under common law, they're under equity. And clearly the Constitution supports and backs up the common law grand jury. Clearly the Constitution supports and backs up, the Bill of Rights backs up and supports the common law grand jury. The Magna Carta backs the common law grand jury. The Holy Bible backs the common law grand jury. The United States Supreme Court rulings back the common law grand jury. But the only thing they have is the equity courts themselves, and they have some rogue legislation out there that is feeding them, you know, all of this unconstitutional law, and they're executing it. But Marbury versus Madison, which was right off the beginning of our nation, is back in 1803, I believe it was, or 1801. I think it was 1803. Where Marbury versus Madison says that anything that's repugnant to the Constitution is null and void. So, clearly, one of our unalienable rights is to have free access into the courts. So when they write legislation like USC 28, that's unconstitutional. Therefore, that's all null and void. And what's really interesting is because they don't have any regulations attached to it, it's not even law in their equity courts, even though they're using it. So they're lawless. Every which way they turn, they're lawless. They're lawless when they use it, even if it did have regulations. They're lawless when they use it because it doesn't have regulations. They're just all lawless altogether. And so we have the upper hand on the courts ultimately. They have control of the courts, but there is a process of court. And once you understand the process and you file the right papers and do the right thing in the right order, all of a sudden you'll see that the process will start to overtake them, because they're going to start worrying about when there's things that they can't do, like they cannot touch or remove a habeas corpus. I don't think any judge has the guts. I don't think any judge has the guts to try to remove a habeas corpus, because an arrest. Well, first of all, the law itself requires that judge to be arrested. We don't even have to do anything. The law requires an arrest on that judge. He's violated the constitutional. He's violated his constitutional authorities. So, all right. Anyway, that's it on that question. Let me click the button for you, Gerard, so you don't get confused. And then after that, you got it. And the next caller is 313. You got it, Gerard?
Yep.
And they're unmuted, so you can take it from there. Now, Sheila, Gina is unmuted. Gina, make sure you keep your mic, muted. Gina's unmuted in case you need her for someone coming in for the CPS stuff.
Right. I wanted to say something on the CPS stuff. As for Sheila and Gina, look, we're having a very big response on this because it is a big problem throughout the nation, and we've had a lot of people sign up. They need people that have good skills for helping people. If you can volunteer, like that woman that was just on, that Sarah Dean or whatever her name is, she said, "I'm illiterate." Well, she's not unintelligent. She's illiterate. She doesn't like, she can't read and write. So she needs somebody to help her fill out those intake papers. Now, she could print them off and maybe find somebody on her end to take care of it, but we certainly could use people who have court experience that know how to deal with people to talk these people through setting their, putting in their cases so that they can go into the suit. And it's really not that difficult if people will step up to the plate and help each other. So I just wanted to mention, we got a lot of people in there, and I'm sure we have people with certain clerical skills and, people skills. So, get a hold of Sheila and get a hold of Gina and volunteer to do that, because this thing is going to grow, and we want to be able to – we don't want to lose people by the wayside because we can't handle them. So with that being said, let's get to our next caller there. There's no name there. It's 3969. You're unmuted. Go ahead.
Hey, Gerard, John, my name is Ruben. I'm normally listening in, and I have completed the civics course. It was very enlightening and educational. Today I've gone to court on a traffic ticket. Like I said, I'm mostly listening in, so that's why if I sound a little odd, that's because I normally don't call in. Anyway, I've been listening for the couple of past, about the last 2 months maybe, and some of the things I've been hearing you guys say is don't even get involved with asking them for their oath of office, and don't even ask about their surety and stuff like that. But this is what I did. I know I'm going to court on three different tickets, and according to the Kansas – I'm from Kansas, by the way, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. According to the Kansas law, three misdemeanors in one court equals one felony. So I have three misdemeanors that I'm going to face charge for. I went today, and they're a speeding ticket. I was doing 52 and a 45, big dangerous Mario Andretti here. And then I have a license that had expired from another state. I just had a birthday in February, and I got a ticket in March, March 9th actually. And also my license plate on the back of my vehicle had expired. Again, it was due on my birthday.
Well, those are not misdemeanors. Those are violations. They're considering those misdemeanors?
Yes.
Because on a misdemeanor, like over here, I don't know how it is out there, but in New York, you can get up to 2 years on a misdemeanor. They don't usually do that, but that's what the law says. And most of that traffic stuff, unless it's, expired, aggravated, unlicensed, or stuff like that, I didn't think they could call them misdemeanors.
Well, they sent me to the municipal court today, and this is a document that I had sent them. First of all, I sent a contract to them saying I accept your contract, even though I was put under contract by a police officer on the side of the road under duress. and I spelled out the terms and conditions of my contract. Well, I also sent another thing to him. I'm going to just read, like, the four things I put in there, and I'm going to tell you what happened today, if that's all right. I put in there that here are the accepted facts. All public servants have sworn an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. All public servants have a surety bond in place as proof that they will act according to their oath. All public servants shall ensure all trials and hearings will be court of records, and all public servants are required to prove jurisdiction when challenged, and proof must be provided in writing. Therefore, I require this court and all officers to provide written proof of their jurisdiction over me before I can proceed. I stand injured because of lack of jurisdiction, and my contract charge of $3,000 is now in effect. Now, I went to court today, and she tried to get me. Now, she'd been a judge, a magistrate, for 30-plus years. Well, she wanted me to sign some kind of contract saying that I accept and I understand my constitutional rights. Well, I told her, I said, before I sign anything else, there's a matter to be resolved about jurisdiction. And if you'll notice in the paperwork, and they all had a copy of it, the judge, the prosecutor, and, of course, I sent the original thing to the police department that gave me the ticket. And the cops, he's standing in the door, and he kind of has a little smug response like, I wrote you the ticket, didn't I? And the judge, she's telling me, well, I have jurisdiction. I can hear you. I can hear your case. I said, according to the, in which I'm telling her the truth, according to the Kansas rules of procedure, you must, when jurisdiction is challenged, you must provide written proof of jurisdiction. And that goes for the judge, that goes for the prosecutor, and for the police department. And, well, she's telling me, yeah, I got it. I can hear the case. I said, well, would you be giving me that in writing? I need that in writing. And the prosecutor, she was a little bit heads up on this thing. She said, well, we can't give it to you today, but what we'll do is we'll research the jurisdiction that we have, and we'll send you a copy of that. So they each took their turn and asked me for my address. And the prosecutor, she's asking me for my address again. I said, well, it's and I told her my address. I said, and for your viewing pleasure, it's on the document that you're holding in your hand, too. So now I left there. They rescheduled for May 5th. Now, like I said, I didn't have to ask them for their oath off or anything.
Well, let me just pipe in here. You know, again,
go ahead.
What you need to be doing is studying a lot of the stuff that we have up there. You studied Thornton. You said you listened to the civics course. I think you said
yes.
That.
Yeah,
and go back and you can get Thornton in there. You know, we also have. You don't have to go back into the civics course to listen to his all of his what do you call it? What do they call them?
Audios.
We'll call audios his lectures. Okay, you can go under books, essays, and lectures, and you'll find them there. And you go back and study his stuff, and then look at our paperwork on under our media. And between those two things, particularly, and if you understand how to write a bit, and all this stuff is going to teach you how to write too, you'll be able to really write a good case. But bear in mind, it's worthless to argue anything. Okay.
Right,
First of all, you're in the court, and you're in a town court or a city court. What court are you in?
It's a municipal court.
Right. So it's under corporate charter. It's not under the Constitution. It's not a court of record. They can't give you justice there, and they don't understand. Most of those people aren't even. And I don't even think half the time the judges are even lawyers. So I mean, they go to judge school for 6 days. You know.
They're going to send him a copy of the statute for their jurisdiction. That's what they're
going
to do. Right.
Yeah. It's stupidity. Look at. I this is what I do. I get a traffic violation. I write a paper. And I answer by paper. If they just go away, they go away, and I'm happy. If they require me to come into the court, I'll go into the court, and I'll just pay the fine. I'll object everything, pay the fine, and go my way and put all my paperwork into the file. And that's what I'm doing now because I don't have time to sue them. But I've got a few of them in my file, and at some point I'm going to sue them all collectively at the same time, and I'm going to hit them for $25,000 apiece for each violation, and just go after them that way. But if you have the time to do it right away, you do it right away. Look, if you go into court once, if you're being pulled into the court on a misdemeanor, especially in a town court or a village court or some kind of municipal court, you're pulling in on a misdemeanor. Well, even if they try to call it a felon, you want to get out of that court right away. You don't want to mess around. You go in one time. They get one time to leave you alone. I object to this whole process. It's not a court of record. You can't give me the Constitution, and this jurisdiction has no authority over me. They're going to steamroll you. I don't even go back to that court. You go home, you write a writ of error, you overturn everything they said in that court, you open up by through and open your court of record there. But you go into the federal court, and you file a violation against them. You sue them for violation of your right of due process, and they've overstepped the jurisdiction. And that shuts that whole court down, okay? The other way you can deal with this is because they're holding you. They're holding you, even though it's figuratively and not literally. You have to go to court every month or whenever they tell you you've got to come. You're in custody. So you could do a habeas corpus. And you can pull yourself out of that court into a federal court. They cannot, they will not respond to a habeas corpus. So at the final results of a habeas corpus, which is also a show cause or cease and desist, a cease and desist order is given at the end of that, and that shuts your court, that court down completely. You don't even have to worry about it no more. Meanwhile, they've also defaulted, and you've already spelled out what you're looking for, $25,000 per issue, and you've counted the issues. You go down to the court clerk, and you bring your paperwork. You file that paperwork with a notice of default and an affidavit concerning the results of that notice of default, and then you go and you lien their property. You take their house, their cars, whatever you can get.
So
why waste your time doing anything else?
Okay, by challenging their jurisdiction, and they didn't have it because I sent it, return receipt requested. So it's been, they've had it for about a month.
No, the last thing, we're giving you experience now. We went to the School of Hard Knocks. Okay, I'm telling you, every judge we've ever asked, we've had judges. My robes are my jurisdiction. I'm sitting in this seat. I got jurisdiction. I got jurisdiction. Let's move on. I hear this. They will never take their jurisdiction away from themselves. I don't ask them for their jurisdiction. I tell them that they ain't got it. And I tell them that. I write one paper, send it in, and that's it. You ain't got jurisdiction. Leave me alone. Go away. And that's that. And if you continue to come after me, then I'm going to get you for violating my unalienable right of due process and acting under the color of law to bring me into a foreign court. Because that's what it is. It's a foreign court.
Two things real quick. One, do you think they're going to give me their proof that they've got jurisdiction? I mean, they can't give me proof that they got jurisdiction.
It's irrelevant. No, they'll make it up and they'll go forward.
I'm telling you, they're going to give you a copy of the statute and the penal law, and they're going to say this gives us our jurisdiction. They don't understand. At that level in those courts, they don't even know what you're talking about, really.
Right.
You almost have to forgive them because they're ignorant.
But take their money while you're forgiving them.
Just file a writ of habeas corpus now?
Well, look, you got to understand how to do that now. Okay, we're going to be if you get together with us on. As a matter of fact, let's do this real quick. Just hang on a second, because I forgot to bring this up, so I got to get it up now. Up on our website, anybody who is an administrator, okay, that is checked up, they're taking our civics course and they check the box administrator. Obviously, a requirement to be administrator, which means one of the four people within the county, that is the investigative body for the grand jury. It's a paid position. There's four in every county across America. You must take the civics course to take on that job and that responsibility and duty. The other thing you need to do is you need to come to the other courses that we're putting together. So if you go up to media page, let me see, is this where I got it? Yes, on media page. Click on media, and you come down, and you click on administrator's vow. It's on the top, right underneath legal documents. There's PDF administrator's vow. You only find it under the PDF. You click on that. You fill out that form, and you mail it to the address. Now, what this is, and I'm going to read this very quickly. It's a very short document.
Where is it at again, John? Say it again,
okay.
Please.
You go up to the website, nationallibertyalliance.org, click on media, on the blue bar, media. Scroll down a little bit, and you'll see legal documents. right under legal documents, you'll see the list of documents. It says administrator's vow. Okay?
Okay.
Now, you click on that and you fill that out. Now, let me open the one I had. Here it is. And I'm going to read this very quickly. You have to put your name, your email, your state, your county, and your phone. You fill it out very clearly, have it notarized, and mail this vow to National Liberty Alliance, 3979 Albany Post Road, Suite 107, Hyde Park, New York, 12538. I'm reading it quick, but just download the document. There it is. And just fill it in and get it notarized. It's a common law jury administrator's vow. And it says, I, you put your name, affiant, being of lawful age, qualified and competent, take the following vow as a common law jury administrator. I vow to the governor of the universe in my capacity as common law jury administrator to ensure that all public servants uphold the United States Constitution and Bill of Prohibition rights, and to carry out all of my actions and deliberations under natural law, principled under justice, honor, and mercy, and to strictly adhere to the following two legal maxims. Number one, every right, when withheld, must have a remedy, and every injury, its proper redress. Number two, in the absence of a victim, there can be no crime, corpus delicti. The state cannot be that victim. I also promise to prepare for the position by taking the NLA Civics course, participate in other NLA-required courses, attend the Monday night meetings, listen to MP3s if I'm unable to attend, and take on necessary leadership roles until I take position as jury administrator in my county. It needs to be signed in front of a notary, notarized, sealed, and then it needs to be mailed to the address above. Only then are you now recorded into a position. And whoever gets this stuff first in first gets the positions in your county first. So you fill out this paper, you mail it out to the address above. We will then file it in our files, and we'll put your list on a special mailing list. And when we have these courses, the first course is going to be on how to write a habeas corpus. It's probably going to take a couple of weeks to do. There'll be probably a 1 hour or 2 hours. A week. We'll probably do it on Wednesday night from 9 to 11, let's say. It might take 2 weeks, two Wednesday night meetings to go through this whole thing. We'll give you the framework of how to write a habeas corpus. You work to join a team because we're writing papers. We'll start using you to help us to write papers. And because as you become administrators, you need to be able to write these papers. You need to understand how to write a writ. You need to understand how to write a bill, a true bill. And it doesn't take much to learn it. We're going to teach you and give you all the forms and framework to do this. It'll be almost like filling out a form, but you'll type it up on your own using a word processor, and you just change what you have to change according to the case that you're dealing with. So anybody who is taking the course or wants to take the course is becoming an administrator, and they need to then get involved now. If we don't have a paper on you, you cannot take that position. You're not qualified, and it would be wrongdoing if we allowed you to take that position. You need to become qualified. So, again, it's going to be a course every, the civics course, and we'll do something once a week. Now, if you're in the civics course and you never check that box as an administrator, you just write next to your email, set me as administrator. Give me short words here, Gerard. Any idea?
Administrator candidate?
No. Well, if you already checked it, you checked it. If you didn't check it, we need to know that you didn't check it. We'll go to look to check it for you. And so you need to say something like, please list me as administrator, something like that. Okay, very short and sweet, right next to your email. And so that we know that when we register you onto the email list, which we'll be sending you messages when something new comes up or information that you need to know, or we're having a meeting, a course on a certain day, whatever it's going to be, not only will we use your email for that, but we'll also use your email to go out online and check the box for you, so you'll register as a administrator, okay? And we'll let you know. There'll be things you'll see on the site that other people won't see. We'll talk about that at the meetings, So again, let me just say that one more time. Anybody that is an administrator or wants to become an administrator must fill out this form. Now go to nationallibertyalliance.org, click on media. It's the first one under legal forms, and it says administrative vow. Open it up, print it out, fill it out, notarize it, mail it in, and then we will notify you.
Okay,
with that, we will move on, and we'll teach you how to do the thing at that meeting, you know, how to do a habeas corpus.
Okay. Whatever you do, you don't want the felony. I can't believe that three speeding tickets would be a felony. I don't believe they're doing that. That's craziness. But you want to make sure, like John says, you get out of here, even if you have to pay a fine and come back. You know, get rid of those tickets and then come back and sue them. You know, if it looks like you're going to get a felony, you lose all your rights with a felony, right? You can't vote.
Yeah, everything.
Come on.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Can't even hold the bullet and put it in your ear.
And look,
that's one of those weird things that if you have three misdemeanors in the same court, it becomes a felony.
I'm not sure those things are all misdemeanors. I don't know. Like, I know speeding.
Yeah, they are.
I know speeding, if you go over so many miles an hour, it changes the charge. It gets worse, you know. Yeah, so three in the same court. So just make sure you're speeding in different towns, that's all. what the hell are they talking about?
Well, they're not courts of record anyway. You can get out of that court. Look, when are you going back to court?
The 5th of May.
Okay,
but
this is April.
Yeah, that's a good point, John.
You
can get out of that court.
Go out to this page, download all those legal documents you see there, start to really work through them. At our first meeting, you'll get a copy of how to write a habeas corpus, all the paper. There's five processes, I think it is, to writing a habeas corpus. And you have to write all five papers and prepare it and get it in and execute it in a certain order. And it's really kind of easy. But if you don't know how to do it, you don't know how to do it. Once we show you, it's going to be old hat. It's a form. It's a framework, and you just got to put your facts in. Take the facts of the case that you see in there out and put your facts in its place. It's that simple.
Okay.
And it's always the same thing, violation of Fifth Amendment. You're unalienable right protected by the Fifth Amendment of due process, and that makes it a federal offense, and they don't have jurisdiction. That's your argument, and it's a slam dunk.
Okay. Now, I beat another court case earlier this year on jurisdiction because they couldn't prove jurisdiction.
Uh-huh.
And they gave you a win? They went away, huh?
Yeah, yep. Sometimes in town courts that happens.
Yeah, they don't want to mess with it. Yeah. Anyway, we should get moving on. We're getting a little lengthy here. We got other people in there and a lot.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, take it easy. Thanks for that. That was good. Okay. Next caller, 1685, you've been unmuted. There's no name and no state.
Yeah, this is Mike in Wyoming.
Mike in Wyoming. How are you doing tonight, Mike?
I'm doing okay. I read two books that you guys publish, Meet Your Straw Man and UCC Connection. I was involved with a common law grand jury group here a couple years back that ultimately disbanded. So I'm not a complete novice to this, but I'm trying to understand some of the arguments in your books. I recently had a speeding ticket too. I guess it's just the nature of us. We're all renegades.
No, they're called speed traps for a reason, but go ahead.
yeah, well, absolutely was. But at any rate, I was in a circuit court, which is a court of general jurisdiction, supposedly here in Wyoming, as are the district courts. Now, you know, under the old system, pre-1933, those courts could administer statutes that were written by the Wyoming legislature, and, you know, there was no problem there. But
once they do that, that makes them a statutory court. They're no longer a court of record.
Okay. Are you guys arguing that 1933 was some kind of punctuation point that the rules changed since then? No.
We have two courts running in the United States. It's been running since the inception of our nation. In 1789, the Constitution was signed. Okay, and in 1789, within 3 months of the Constitution not being signed, but actually being ratified, and now we have a nation. Within 3 months, they had the 1789 Judiciary Bill. Okay, and what that did is it gave the authority, the legislators gave additional authority to the judiciary, allowing them to operate under the rules of chancery. And what that ultimately did, between that and some other acts that took place, you have the Organic Act of 1873, I think it was, or 71. So you have the Organic Act, and you got some other things going on, and collectively it created a whole new court system. Now, unfortunately, a couple of United States Supreme Court justices who were on our side and understood what was going on, they allowed the credibility of those courts to exist. And because of that, I think, and this is my theory, because of that, it seems that all these Supreme Court justices assumes it has some authority and clout and power. Now, they're de facto courts, and we want to get into the de jure courts, that which is operating under common law, and we have to bring that and make that happen ourselves. Now, those court buildings are all our court buildings. We paid for them. We manned those court buildings. We paid for the building. We paid the heat. We paid for the supplies and to furnish and everything else in that building. And so there's no reason for us to pay for anything else, but those are our buildings. Now, they're called federal district courts. Now, they claim, certain groups of people claim that under Article 4 that these other courts were created. And I can assure you, there's no doubt in my mind, I could debate this any day of the year, that's just another fantasy of theirs. It doesn't exist in Article 4. And the words that they use, and they connect it to Article 1, Section 9, I think it is, 8 or 9, paragraphs 17 and 18, they tie Article 4 or something in there to that, and they claim that they had the authority to create this other court. So this other court that has come up is a court of fiction. It's a de facto court. It's not real.
I'm not so concerned about.
Okay, but you have to understand this whole thing, because the bottom line is you're going into United States District Court into a court of chancery.
I'm talking to state circuit court or a state's district court.
Well, I understand that. What they've done is they've incorporated this all the way down. All of the states have been incorporated. All the towns have been incorporated. There's a few exceptions. All of the counties have been incorporated. They've all gone into corporate charters, and they fall under the whole federal district system that they set up going back to the Judiciary Act of 1789 and back to the Organic Act of 1870, 71 or 73. And so they're all operating under the same thing, whether they realize it or not. They're all operating as chancery courts, because they're operating under the rules of chancery and not under the rules of common law. They don't know what common law is. And they certainly do not apply the Constitution. Okay? None of those courts do. So what you have to do is you have to get out of those courts. You have to open up your own court. If you're in a state Supreme Court, a court that is a court of record but operating as a chancery court, you open your court of record in that court. The moment they violate your unalienable rights, okay, of due process, the fact that they're robbing you of your court, that's the right of due process, that makes it a federal issue. And you move it. You take all those people into the federal court and sue them, but you stay in your state court to continue on whatever lawsuit you're doing there. Okay. Now, if it is that they pulled you into that state court or that court, once you finish the problem on the federal court, you'll shut that down because they have to cease and desist. That's where, instead of just, if you want to do more, you want to sue them, but you also want to do a habeas corpus on yourself to pull yourself into the federal court. They can't answer that, and that'll shut down other court because they have to cease and desist because it was a show cause and they defaulted. That's the process. That's the procedure. So you have to put all this together. It's not really, you know, if it's new stuff to you and it's new hat, it seems overwhelming. Maybe it seems like a lot of new stuff. But there's only a few things you have to realize. You know, you have to understand what they did with the Judiciary Act, the Organic Act. You have to understand how the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. You have to read it and really, you know, work through it. We did a a paper of a writ of quo warranto, which we filed on all 94 federal courts. Now, if you go read that, it's up on our page on National Liberty Alliance, right under media, which was filing of the cases. If you read that, that steps through the authorities of the Constitution. Every authority that the legislator has is inside that writ of quo warranto. Anything that we don't talk about, we show them that's null and void. You have no power and you have no authority, and now you are, you're doing violence against the people and violence against the Constitution. We did the same thing with the judiciary under Article 2, and we did the same thing with the administrative under Article 3, all in that one paper. So that's an educational paper, and it explains the Constitution. The quo warranto explains the powers that these three legislative bodies have according to the Constitution. Anything else, they don't have. Okay.
What's unclear to me, and I followed your comments here. The Organic Act of 71. I realize that incorporated the District of Columbia.
Correct.
Or reincorporated, it actually was already.
Well, that's where they referred, you see, the Organic Act of 71 is where they referred to what they're calling, I don't know that they actually mentioned it in there, but later on they mentioned this, and you'll hear actual justices talking about this. What was that woman's name that wrote that paper, Alaska judge, which is probably a fantasy too? Whatever her name is, she wrote a paper, and she referred to the fact that they came up with the authority and the ability
Anna.
She wrote, now she's got some errors in her writing, because she said that they had the authority under Article 4. Well, look, she's a pretty bright woman, if she's real. I don't even know if she's real. She's very bright. Whoever wrote that paper is extremely bright. They understood the game. They walked it all the way through, and they failed at the most simplest place, that Article 4. I think it's Article 4, Section 4, if I recall. I'll have to look it up. But they're claiming that therein was the authority to write, to create these Article 4 courts that operate in the Article 3 district courts. And, I mean, this was elementary. There's no way anybody who understands what she understands to make that kind of mistake, okay? It's just not possible.
Where do these guys get the authority to do anything to the state courts? I mean, that's
where does who get authority?
Whether it's the Judiciary Act of 1789 or the Organic Act of 1871, where does the federal government, which is an agency of the states, where do they get off making any changes in the state courts? They should be independent.
Well, that was sealed during the coup in 1963 when they took out the president. Okay, it actually took place long before that, but that's when the rubber hit the road and the message was sent out, and nobody dares crosses it anymore.
Was this so we don't flog a dead horse here? Is this explained in some of your material in your coursework? Or?
Not what we're talking about right now. Maybe a little later it will be, but not right in the moment. If you read Anna Van, whatever her name is, from Alaska, maybe. Maybe someone can tell you where that link is to read her article. And you go read her article, she lays it out very, very well. She's extremely knowledgeable. She's got everything is on point, okay, with the exception of when she refers to the power and the authority to create what she called an Article 4 court. There's no place in this book where it talks about the Article 4 court.
Well, that's where
it doesn't exist. The
District Court of the U.S. U.S. District Court, which sounds like a nitpicking affair.
Well, no, you see, that's an interesting.
They changed from Article 3 to Article 1 jurisdiction, where
That's so fantasized. I mean, it doesn't even. It's just off this planet. They'd be laughed out of any conversation of logic if they tried to talk about an Article 1 court. And I think the same thing with an Article 4 court. The only court that has authority in this nation is an Article 3 court. And it's called an Article 3 because it's under Article 3. It's where the power is given to the judiciary. And it reads that the judicial power of the state shall be invested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts that as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges both of the Supreme and the inferior courts shall hold their offices during good behavior. Good behavior is interpreting about as behaving and exercising and executing the Constitution and not going outside of that authority and jurisdiction. But it goes on in Section 2. It says the judicial power shall extend in cases of law and equity arising under this Constitution and the laws of the United States. Now, for the first time in history, and I'm just saying this because of my own experience, I don't know if ever there was an equity court that was a common law court before this court that was created in 1789, okay? Because this court, which is an equity court, you go into Black's Law Dictionary, you go into Proviers, you go into history, you go anywhere. All equity courts operated under Chancery. But the United States created an equity court, understanding that they kind of needed an equity court because it releases the pressure and you get a lot of cases run through very quickly. You don't have to go through the expense and all of the jury trials and all that other stuff. So they wrote the equity courts in, but then they sealed their authority under Article 6, where it says in Article 6, Paragraph 2, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all the treaties made of which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges, now where do you find judges? You find judges in equity courts. Where else do you find judges? You don't find judges anyplace else. If you go into a court of law, they're magistrates. Now, you may have a magistrate judge. That means he can go into both. He can act as magistrate in courts of law, or he can act as a judge in a court of equity. If they're just magistrates, they can only operate in the courts of law. But all the Constitution, in New York Constitution and other places, it says that all judges, I think maybe even the U.S., I don't recall, but all judges are magistrates, okay? That's in law. That's a Supreme Court ruling. It's found in New York court. It's found in the New York Constitution. I'm sure many others. So under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. The judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. It cannot stand up to it. So now the judges are professional or political jurists. And there's an appellate system set up in an equity court system. You got a court, the Court of Appeals and the Appellate Court. You can appeal up twice. And now that's a one-jurist court. And he has to act in good behavior. He has to go according to the American jurisprudence book that is written for the purpose of judges to know what they can do and what they can't do. Everything is very clear in there. And you know, I'm in total agreement with everything I've ever read there. And so they have to obey that. They're a jurist, and they have to be obedient to the Constitution, and they have to make good judgments. Now, if he or she doesn't make a good judgment, you can peel it up to the next step, which I think there are four judges. I think it's three and one spare wheel. Okay, when we went up here to New York to those courts. So you got an appellate court, and they should fix the problem there. They should say, hey, look, you made a mistake here. You can't do this. The Constitution requires this, or whatever the case may be. And they overturn them, and they apply justice. Then there's also that second shot. And then there's the ultimate shot, which if it's a constitutional issue, you could take it up to the United States Supreme Court. Now, once you're in the equity courts, you have to stay in the process of court. In other words, if you start off in a court, in a trial court, and then you appeal it, or you want to go straight into the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court will throw it out and say, no, you have to exhaust your state effort first. And then you have to prove it's a case that we'll accept, because it's got to be a constitutional issue. It's got to be directly violating your unalienable rights, because that's the only authority that they really have to really listen to. That's the jurisdiction of the court. Let me read it one more time. Let's see, where was that? Here's the jurisdiction of the court, Article 3, Section 2. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution and the laws of the United States. Usually we go in for Bill of Rights violations. So, but if you're fighting it in a state court, first of all, they don't have the authority to hear a Bill of Rights violation. Okay, rights of your unalienable rights. They don't have the authority to do it, because automatically that becomes a federal case. So generally speaking, very, very, very few cases are able to go through the state courts and then end up in the United States Supreme Court. Very few. Most of the cases that end up in the United States Supreme Court spring forth out of the federal courts.
I guess I need to see this article that you're referring to by Anna Van whoever.
Yeah.
Because this is
Anna Van.
Anna Von Ritz. Anna Von Ritz. R-I-T-Z.
You can probably Google her. You'll get her.
Yeah, you can put it in Google. She has a site. She has like 26 articles, but
we don't know if she's real, though.
Yeah, I haven't been able to find any. She claims to be in the Alaska court system, and I did a little research and didn't find her name anywhere, unless she's claiming to be in some system outside of their system, like a de jure court. I don't know how she does that, but anyway.
Well, her writing is brilliant in the sense that it understands exactly, if you really want to understand how things work and how they put it together and what happened, you read it. But it lacks two things. Number one thing it lacks is she dreams this fantasy up, which is part of their stupid process anyway, and she falls in line with it on this Article 4 court. And if she was against these people, automatically she would say, these people are crazy. It doesn't say that in there. You can't find it in there. It's not there, okay? I challenge anyone to show me an Article 4 court in the Constitution, which is only about six paragraphs or so. Where you going to show me it, if it's that many paragraphs? Okay, so that's one problem. Problem number two is the fact that once she finishes laying this whole thing out, it's clearly fraud. Fraud is a fraud. It's null and void. It's irrelevant. Has no power, no authority. It's done. So you see, if you want to go after these people, you go after them for fraud on the court, and you have to go through this whole system of laying out that it's fraud. But that takes the people. Therein is NLA. You see, we need to have the power of the people to push this through.
Almost everything these guys do, and I'm talking attorneys here, whether at state level or federal level, is fraud. I mean,
yes.
House Joint Resolution 192, whatever it was, that...
I think that's an understatement, because I don't think there's anything that they do that isn't fraud.
Yeah, a resolution of any kind by Congress, joint or otherwise, does not have the force and effect of law. So this was simply an opinion coming out of both chambers of Congress that Roosevelt had lawfully put us in bankruptcy. That meant nothing. I mean, it was like taking a...
Yeah, only Congress has the power to write law. I mean, that's it. But on top of that, okay, you don't even have to get involved in all the other arguments or anything. All you have to do is understand the power and the authority given to them, the legislatures. And if you go to Article 1, Section 8, and you can go right through the list very quickly, power to lay taxes, duties, and imposts and exercises, but it's very specific on what? On all these things that we're going to talk about, to borrow money, to regulate commerce, to establish uniform law of naturalization, uniform laws are subject to bankruptcies, to coin money, to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting, to establish post offices and post roads, and they sold our post offices. We, the people, want our post office back. To promote the progress of science and useful arts, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, and that, of course, is the district courts, to define the punishment, piracies or felonies committed on the high seas, to declare war, letters of marque, and reprisal, to raise and support armies, and to give them money only for terms of 2 years at a time, to provide for and maintain a navy, government and regulations of the land and naval forces, to provide for the calling forth of the militia and suppress insurrection and repel invasion, to provide for the organizing, arming, and the disciplining of the militia, okay, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, such districts not exceeding 10 square miles, that's for Washington, D.C., which is the seat of government of the United States. And the last is number 18, is to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper to carrying out the execution of all of the foregoing. So, you see, it's very, very limited. Okay? So if they, you, whatever it is that they do, if you can't find the authority in this one whole Section 8, if you can't find it in there, they ain't got it. And that's your argument. You don't need to argue anything else.
Agreed. But the states... are limited only by the requirement to provide a Republican form of government. Other than that, they can, if they want to write a law that says everyone has to wear pink hats, they can do it.
No, they can't.
It doesn't even make sense. Of course they can't.
Oh, no. They cannot do it because why? You know why? Because you need to go back to the Constitution and read the preamble, okay? We the people. U.S. Constitution. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. Five or six things. Just that's what the purpose of government is. What I just read right there. Now, that's the purpose of government. Hold on.
But we were not parties to the
Constitution. But hold on. Of course we were. Of course we were. For us and our posterity. Listen.
Only indirectly through the state.
No. You've been
poisoned. That's how the Supreme Court has ruled.
It doesn't matter. That's null and void. You've been poisoned. They have been poisoned. And there's a lot of other stuff that we can prove that that's wrong, null and void. It's repugnant to the Constitution. Let me finish the point here because it's all right here. So what we the people established the United States in order to do certain things. And we listed them out. Establish justice. We have to make sure they establish justice, ensure the domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The Article 3s, Article 1, which is legislative, Article 2, which gives judicial powers, and Article 3, which gives administrative powers, they are all under the Constitution. I'm one of the people who ordained and established. I'm above the Constitution. We ordained and established it for them, not for me. Now, nowhere in this Constitution and legislation anywhere do we give them the authority to go out and write statutes to control our behavior. That is repugnant to common law, the essence, the Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, the Holy Bible. It's repugnant to everything. Which means they can write the statutes according to the authority we gave them in Section 8 of Article 1. They cannot go beyond that, okay? And now you go to the states and say, oh, well, that's for the federal government. It has nothing to do with us. Oh, yeah, really? If it violates my unalienable right of travel, if it violates my unalienable right of wanting to smoke some pot because I like to get high or I'm using it for health reasons, or if it violates my unalienable right to do anything that I want to do, okay? And what is it that I can do that is not illegal? As long as I do not injure another party, morally or physically, I can do it. Now, I can do things that might injure a party morally in public but wouldn't be in private. In other words, you wouldn't go out and have a sexual intercourse with someone in the street, so you do it in the privacy of your own home. It's purely legal to do whatever you do between two consenting adults, but it purely is a problem to do it out in public, okay? And but other than that, they can't write any laws of your behavior. And the Supreme Court has ruled on that numerous times. Only have to obey the natural law, not the laws of men. We didn't sign up for that. Now people will say, well, we didn't sign that contract. Oh, absolutely we did. The contract ultimately was between God and man. That contract took place long, long time ago. And we see it, the first place that we understand it in any kind of power and authority was up on the mountain with Moses. That's the first place the contract became obvious and was written down. Prior to that, it was still applied earlier. But then the next time it was applied, they applied that for 400 years of total, a wonderful government, a wonderful power and authority over the area they lived in. They controlled their lives, and a very powerful government for 400 years under God. And then the second time it came about was under England. They made the mistake, same thing that Israel made the mistake with. They went out and told God that, hey, we want a king. God says, I'm your king. What do you need a king for? Oh, no. We want a king like the rest of the nation. So they gave him Saul, and we know how that turned out. Okay, so when the United and so England did the same problem. They went to get themselves a king to protect their liberties. That was a major problem. God was their king. The Magna Carta had it right, but they blew it out. But unfortunately, the king was before the Magna Carta, so they were trying to really tie down the king. And that's what the purpose of the Magna Carta. When our founding fathers came to work this whole thing out, they worked it out, of course, going back to Mosaic law, looking to the Anglo-Saxons, putting it all together. England already was in the game, pretty much pulling all that together and say, but we're not going to have a king because King God is our king. And that's the court of justice. You see, we act under principles. The seat that is the bench – The king's bench is ultimately God as king, and we the people sit on that, and we execute God's will and authority through principles. That's all we have to do is just be principled. And anyone could be principled and taught principles. Even an evil person could be taught principles, and they can fake it. Principles are principles. And so once you execute justice through principles, you're now under God. It's God ruling you, and that's the way it is. So anything that violates that, anything that isn't of nature and of God, is a violation to try to control my behavior. My moral or immoral behavior is my business. It's not yours or anyone else's. And that's the big thing we have to realize.
Okay. I think we all agree that we want to get back to, you know, no harm, no foul,
mm-hmm.
to put it succinctly as I can. Just one other point. You were talking about regulations being necessary for statutes.
Right.
Most of my experience is in Title 26. I got hung up on that for some years. And
Title 26 in itself says that it has it is not law.
Well, the point I was going to make is that regulations are not necessary to statutes. If the statute calls for a regulation, then it has to be there. And you know, there are different kinds of regulations. There are implementing regulations, there are interpretive regulations, there are procedural regulations.
Well, U.S. versus Merksey says something different. That's the United States Supreme Court making a ruling on that. And they're the ones that said it, not me. It says the result is that neither the statute nor the regulations are complete without the other. And only together do they have any force.
Well,
that's U.S. versus Merksey.
Okay. Yeah, but that's when the statute calls for regulation. Some statutes are considered self-executing. They're clear enough on their face that they don't require regulation to...
Well, no. That's not what the Supreme Court says. They say there's two parts to a law. And they can be self-righteous, and the legislators could play their word game all they want. It's just more null and void stuff. I mean, it's null and void. It's violence against the Constitution.
I'm in the real world here, and, people have had their heads handed to them by arguing that there's no implementing
regulation.
No,
you're not in the real world. You're in the fiction world, and that's why they're getting their heads handed to them, because they're not in the real world. If they were in the real world, they would be standing up to these people in courts of law, and they would be applying their unalienable rights, and they wouldn't pussyfoot around. They'd immediately go to the next step, because once you pussyfoot around, they're going to steamroll you, and you're going to go to jail. But you have to turn that around and put that there under the threat of jail. And the way you do it is you keep violating them for your right of due process.
Well,
if a judge wants to take the seat and do the same thing, you're welcome to do that.
Well, when you go in there, they have a presumption. And if you don't kill the presumption, then they're presuming that you're under their fiction. You see, they have a presumption that you're a U.S. citizen, that you fall under this. And they presume that everybody comes in. So if you don't state who you are and where you are and how you're coming out, and if you when you say this is a court of record, what you're doing is you're laying to bed their presumption. You're saying, no, don't presume this about me. I'm telling you that I am this man, you know what I mean, under God, under the Constitution, and now you have to treat me under the Constitution because I'm not your slave, your presumption. You're a 14th Amendment citizen and all that stuff. So, I mean, people don't realize it. And the other thing is even the people that do realize it, they play these little games to suck you back into their jurisdiction, especially when you're going up in tax court. They'll change the jurisdiction as he's talking to you. You'll be in equity. You'll be in admiralty. You don't know where you're going. And those judges are experts at getting you to stick your foot in your mouth and agree to something when you don't even realize you're agreeing to it.
By the way, someone called earlier and was asking about what do you do when they disappear your filings in court. And you offered some suggestions. One of the things she might do is swear out a criminal complaint, because that's obstruction of justice.
Yeah, we refile it and put it on the record. We've had a judge turn our stuff out, and he actually gave it back to us. We sent it back, chastised him on paper. We revealed his sin and violation of the law on paper, and he didn't send it back a second time.
Yeah.
You see, but that was in our naive days. But today, you see, look at, we're coming from a different perspective now, okay? The people do have a problem to make sure that this is applied and kept in the records. And one of the things is definitely is to, once you realize it's gone, is to put it on the record that it's been gone and resubmit it so it's in the record. I'm going to send it back a second time because somebody, you know, broke an entry here and took the stuff out of the file. But you see, us coming in, what we're doing at National Liberty Alliance, coming in as a unified United States common law grand jury, is filing in all 94 federal courts. There's no way they're going to be able to expunge that.
All right. Liz, I appreciate your info here. I'll let you move on to other questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I think we covered a lot of good stuff that people need to understand and know, to have the knowledge of all these things.
A lot of people heard that for the first time tonight. I know you've done it before, but it's good to go through it every now and then. And like you said, that article by Anna Von Rich, she really did lay that out pretty good as far as to take us from where, you know, from here to there.
Right.
I thought it was very well. Okay, I'm going to hit next question here.
Hi, that's Jason from Jersey.
Hey, Jason,
hey,
what are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to be alive and pressing forward with everything here in Jersey. I love that paper you had on the Office of Professional Responsibility via the Marshals Service. And it's interesting, when I was working with the marshal's supposed to take over what the sheriff isn't doing. And their response is, oh, we don't investigate that. You have to go to the attorney general's. And again, my papers, just a note, my papers that I had filed in December of 2014 were eventually removed and sent back to me.
Just a quick response on that, Jason. Look, when they said that to you, you should have said, oh, they had a constitutional convention and gave the constitutional authority to the attorney general? Is that what happened? Because that's the question
not.
You have to ask.
We know that.
But that's what they're telling you.
Oh, yeah.
They're telling you that he now has my job. They took my job away from me and gave it to him. If the marshals only understood how powerful they are, if they only understood, they're as powerful as the sheriff. The president of the United States can't even get rid of a marshal. A judge cannot get rid of a marshal. Nobody can, not even the people. Well, the people can get rid of him only a grand jury can get rid of a marshal. That's it. There's nobody else that can touch it. And when he holds the law, as long as the people are in agreement with him, there's no one that's going to touch him.
Right, and we know that. But again, the thing is that the obstinance of these individuals who are I call them uncivil servants, are there on the bequest of the people, but they are there serving their masters. And remember, as you said in the past, and everything, you can only serve one master. That's either the republic or the corporation. You can't do both. What's going on with is any more news coming on from our from Stephen Dean and his trials and tribulations? Any news coming down?
I'm still waiting for some more information. I got most of the information, and I think we'll be writing this in the next couple of days, but we can't complete it until we finish off the information. There's a form that we're waiting for Lydia to get back to us.
Okay.
So if you want to push Lydia along, give her a call. And reminder, we need that form to go forward. We'd like to file it right away.
Yeah, I've been trying to get a hold of her anyway. On another point is that how is the militia papers coming along?
Which militia papers?
Tell me what I said
before I respond.
Last week, basically, our militia, I'm doing it in effect in New Jersey. New Jersey has a statute.
Yeah, but tell me what I said. Tell me what I said.
That you were working to do something on the working to reestablish a firm paper on for the militias in the.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't started that particular paper because there's a couple of things that involves the militia. But the one that you're talking about is what we read in the Constitution tonight. Which was the in Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 8, It talked about the power of the legislature, and the legislature was to provide for the necessity of the militia.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't provided for that. That's a federal requirement, okay? That's a federal government. We're going to start pressing the legislature through the courts to start providing the states for the militia. You know, all this money that they're giving out to Homeland Security should be going into the militia. What the hell's wrong with these people? Well, we know what's wrong with them. We've been subverted.
Well, again, subverted and perverted. And they think they're masses, but they're only betas.
Yeah, let me read this. I want to read this again because it's powerful, and people need to understand this. They need to know it. This is in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Look, at you people, everybody has to know the Constitution inside out. This is the key to your power, your authority, your knowledge. That's what it is, your knowledge. So the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Magna Carta, and I dare to say the Holy Bible, you need to focus in. But right here is the power and the authority. This is Article 1, Section 8 to the legislators. Their purpose is to provide for the calling forth of the militia, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Now, there's a little more of that going over to Article 4, which they need to guarantee a Republican form of government that ties into this. But the next part of the sentence, which is 16, says, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them that may be employed in the services of the United States, reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia accordingly to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So it's supposed to be uniform across the United States, but the actual control and the authority and the appointment of officers come from the governor, from the state. Each state gets to control the militia in their own state. Now, it is true that the federal government can call forth the militia. It says so right here. And for what purposes, of course, that's the next question. But ultimately, you know, we had situations where the militia was called out of one state to go and give aid to another state. As a matter of fact, Jackson was leading the militia. I forget out of what state to what state, but he was in there, and that's where he got his notoriety. The militia is an important part of security. Now, on top of that, we also read in the Constitution, Article 2, and everybody should know this one, a well-regular militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Now, I need to read that again. This is the Bill of Rights, Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. You cannot have a free state if you don't have a militia. And right now, our militia is broken. So we have to be real careful. And that's why I say we have to work with the sheriffs really hard. And he's got the power of posse comitatus. So
yeah.
Once these sheriffs work together and they understand their power and they understand their authority and they start to see the subversion in the federal city, then under posse comitatus, they could do something about it. You see, so we'll work with the posse comitatus at this point, which actually is the militia anyway, but under the authority of the sheriff, we work with them to do what has to do, because this problem is not a military problem, you know, it's a legal problem. And
right.
But we do have to start pressing Congress to do their job. Where are we going to get the money? Take it from, you know, take everything from Homeland Security. Take it all. All the money, take it all, and give it to the state's militia, because that's only a duplication. You don't need that. We're going to tell them that.
And for people to know that the Homeland Security was established in 2001 with an Executive Order 5 from Bush. And remember, all executive orders are null and void, because where's the authority coming from? 154 years of Lincoln's perversion is still affecting us. We have it in our governors giving executive orders. We have
right.
The
well, well, we go
that.
Back. You're absolutely right here, and we do cover this in the Quo Warranto. And look at Article 3. You go into Article 3, which gives the power. Not Article 3. Article 2, I'm sorry. You go to Article 2, which gives the power and the authority to the executive power, And nowhere in there do you see executive orders. You're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, he's not even, the President of the United States is not Commander-in-Chief. He, let me repeat that. The President of the United States is not the Commander-in-Chief. He is only the Commander-in-Chief only during certain periods of times. Number one, the first thing that has to happen in order for him to be in position to become a the Commander-in-Chief, the very first thing has to happen is Congress has to declare war. Mm-hmm. The second thing that has to happen is Congress has to call the President. You know, that's very interesting that there's a two-part structure to that. Not only does Congress have to declare the war, but Congress has to call the President into service. And that means that leaves it open that if they don't call him into service, he's not Commander-in-Chief. And that leaves it open to another whole different story because I think our founding fathers, maybe they thought this one out a little bit on this because of this situation we have today.
Thank God for their envision, their ability to see into the future. Because if they were here now, they'd probably go, "My Lord, where did you guys come out of? What roach infested?"
I think our founding fathers would be in Washington right now, doing things. That's what I don't want to say because then they'll say I'm promoting something. I'm not. Promoting the power of the pen. That's what National Liberty Alliance is promoting, the power of the pen and the authority of the people and the command to obey the law. And to them, that's terrorist.
Okay. I just want to say they didn't necessarily see into the future. Well, they did, but it was with the lamp of history. There's nothing new that's going on now that hasn't happened in the past. And they knew it. They were students of history.
Happening in their day, yeah.
That's right. And they saw it.
It happened in the days of Magna Carta.
They knew, and all they had to do was take those things that happened and use their imagination a little bit to see where they would go. I mean, they did extrapolate some of that stuff out, and they said, well, if you do this, you'll probably end up like that, because they had seen other civilizations and countries and stuff that happened to. But really, it was the fact that they were students of history. And you see, one of the things they do in this in the world today, in America especially, is they revise our history, and they don't teach, and they also don't teach civics, which is your relationship with your government. So we got a bunch of dumb people. So are we going to repeat history? You're damn right we're going to repeat history, because we don't know it. So,
right.
You know, it's almost like Putin said about Obama. He said, I don't know what he thinks he's doing, putting these socialistic ideas up there of the economy and foreign policy. He said, we tried them for 83 years and they didn't work, you know. I mean, he probably even believes that he's being very progressive and very innovative and all that stuff, but it's just the same old crap rehashed differently. That's all. Anyway, I'll stop.
Very good points. They're very good points. But there's nothing wrong with that's the point. I'm not going off that. I've been talking about this since the 90s. I call it social capitalism. We are people of a social being. We work together. We have to, and that's the social part. And then we understand the power of capitalism. And when you have cooperation of the community makes what it needs to be done. Why do we need to have business? What is business? Business is a little mom-and-pop shop that got exploded. And we see what Enron did. I'd like to, with that, again, New Jersey is doing its part for its militia. And I've been trying to get a hold of the Adjutant General. I just found out, he won't be in the States until another month. And I turned around to the Secretary, Terry, and I said, Terry, this is very important. Who's second in command? Well, you got General so-and-so. All right, I need to see him because time is running out. And everyone's got to get out there and do their part. Look, right now, I think this is the greatest time of having fun with the beast. They can't stand the light. They can't stand the truth. And when you say no to them, they go ballistic. They'll lie to you in court. And look,
death in Numerica. How many people have been who are NLA members have been attacked by the beast right now? 10? Is it under 10? Guys? Hello?
Well, we don't. I don't know how many NLA members per se have been attacked because they're NLA members. You know what I mean? I can't tell you that.
I right now we have about 4 or 5 that I know. We even had one that was even practicing what he wanted to do, not showing his license, and they shot him dead because he didn't have a proof of. I mean, it's just getting deplorable. Anyway. I apologize. I'm just anal that way because the numbers mean it's very important to me. What is it? I just heard that the number was 400 policemen, 400 people, Americans are killed a year by the police. Now it's doubled. It's 800. So if, and 180, policemen are killed by the sovereigns a year. So let's double that. So it now we're up to 300. And 60. But again, there is a part in the Constitution that says anyone who subverts and uses violence against government is a violation. Well, I want to say here. All right. I apologize. Anyway, I'll let it go. But again, we don't preach violence. We preach the peace, and peace is the most important thing because when you're at peace with yourself, the enemy cannot live off your fear. And let's not be fearful. Let them be fearful of us. I am back to you. The floor is back to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chase.
Thank you so much. God bless.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay. Next caller, you're unmuted.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hey, Todd. First, I want to say with all my heart and all my soul, God bless the two of you for what you're doing. I recently got involved. Been in the state courts chasing my children through 3 states and judges just take them away and that kind of thing. And I won in Georgia in 2012, but she allowed the mother of my children to go to Texas, and then she took the kids away from me again without cause, and the judges said I can't see my children. And as a consequence of that, I found your site. And I'm amazed at what you're doing. And I want to help in any way that I can. My current disability was a car accident. I'm going to have about 2 or 3 surgeries. So I'm home, and I have lots of time. So what I'm doing is studying. I have a real estate background, so I understand a lot of real estate law, a mortgage broker, a title agent. And this stuff is engraved in my heart, you know, what you're teaching everybody. It was already written in my heart from birth. Being a child of God, it's somehow in your consciousness, you know. It's in your soul. So it's a matter of me being able to... Yeah, it's there. And I want to tell you that I'm a patriot, United States Marine, and I also believe in the peaceful warrior, the power of the pen. But I want to offer my services in any way that I can serve you guys in your quest to uphold our rights.
Did you send me an email?
I sent an email to Sheila with my resume, and I had 3 questions regarding...
I sent it from a U.S. Marine. Do you have a detective's background or some kind of a... law enforcement background or investigation background?
Okay. No, sir.
Well, definitely, look, we need everybody. And we are creating committees, and if we got somebody with a new kind of a skill, we'll create a new committee to do the things that need to be done. And so you should call... What is your main skill or background?
My skill is I'm a teacher, trainer, a mediator. I get things done. I've managed the biggest properties in New York City and in Florida. And I have a real estate law background.
Okay, so it sounds like something you could work with us on a level of training people, because we're starting a training course now, teaching them to write to begin with. We have to teach them principles, orientation. And it's all about organizing and getting the necessary skills. And each of us in our own counties have got to execute these skills in order to take control of our nation. We need to take it at the county level. And
absolutely.
So take our civics course. Make sure you click on administrator and become an administrator in your county. And that's kind of a future position. But between now and then, you can get involved more in depth with the course that we're putting together. And then look at the committees. There's all kinds of things wherever you want to work, but people need to get together and work.
No doubt about it. And like I said, however you can use me, I'm at your service. I admire the way you tie this together, you know, and it's just what you guys are doing is just amazing. Amazing. And you have this stuff down. You've done this all your life, haven't you?
No, actually, we just started this about 5 years ago on the judicial end. We first time I've been in a court, other than as a contractor, you know, in general arbitration. But the courts themselves and fighting there, it's about, what, 5 or 6 years now, Gerard?
Yeah, 5 or
something
6
like
years,
that.
Yeah, since we went.
But you know what? When you have a love for this stuff and you get into the real law, it becomes so easy. And I'm a student of the Bible for 30 years or so. So that gave
me that.
Sort of an advancement.
No doubt about that. No doubt about it. God bless you. Thank you for all you do. Like I said, I'm at your service. I'm learning. It locked me out of the civics course, so I sent tech support a request. I don't know why it knocked me out of civics. I can't get back in.
Give me a call tomorrow. 845-233-6560.
I'm sorry, my pen quit writing. What's the number?
845-233-6560.
Six,
give me a call.
I
if you miss me a couple hours later, you'll get me.
John, thank you so much. Gerard, thank you. Good night.
Yeah.
God bless you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to move right along. We only got a few minutes. Pennsylvania, Jim.
Yeah, it's Jim here, Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Hey, listen, first-time caller, but I had talked to you, John, back when the Robert Schultz hearing was up in Albany, and it was transferred to another court.
Yep, I remember.
Okay, listen, a couple things. I have talked to Kathleen about my wife transcribes all 3 hours of the call every Monday night, and we use that for other meetings. I think at the time back then, Kathleen said you would not have time to, you know, review the minutes before you could, you know, disperse them. But I just want to offer that service.
Well,
that
absolutely. Look at, you know, even if there's mistakes in it, you know, the world is full of mistakes. We got lots of mistakes. You know, we just fix them when we find them, you know. But, yeah, we could definitely use that. And she lives, you guys live in the New York area?
Pittsburgh.
Oh, you live in Pittsburgh,
Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yeah, because we're looking for someone down around Westchester, Putnam County, Rockland County, somewhere down in there to do filing work for us because, you know, so anyway. But, you know, yeah, we could definitely use that. Give me a call tomorrow. You got my number, 845-233-6560. Yeah, give me a call tomorrow. Let's talk a little bit about it.
Okay, well, listen, just a couple housekeeping items. You know, that T-shirt thing, a lot of people are big on the T-shirts, and it's been posted, and the webmaster has never made that operable.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get a hold of that webmaster, and, you know, that's me, by the way. I just haven't had the time. I got the book sitting on the desk, and I keep saying to myself, I got to make the phone call, set it up with this guy, and offer T-shirts. And, you know, look, it's good to get the word out through T-shirts and bumper stickers and cards and different things. And at the same time, National Liberty Alliance gets funded a little more, so we definitely have to do that. I'm going to try to do that this week. I really am. But I'm so overloaded. There's so many things going on. And we need more help. We're always calling out for help. People need to get involved. And, you know, I know we have a program going where there should be a welcoming committee. So anybody that's been coming in the last few months, when they come in, they should be getting a phone call from the welcoming committee and getting some information about what they skills they have and how they might be able to help and all that other stuff. So hopefully we'll be able to build up the you know, enough people to do all the things that need to be done.
Yeah, John, I'm real big on the highway signs. Now, other people in our group are very big on the T-shirts, and they're disappointed they can't order these T-shirts because we want to be unified.
I'm going to try to work on it tomorrow.
Very good. And, you know, I got to put a plug in for our coordinator in Pennsylvania. Jan is doing a fabulous job.
Yeah.
He's
everywhere.
Great.
Kidding me? Every time I turn around, I see his name somewhere. So, yeah, he's an active guy.
So listen, John, I got one more thing I got to share with you. Several years ago, we were studying the Pennsylvania Rules of Court, and here is one of the listings in this Pennsylvania Rules of Court that if an attorney gives the Mason sign to a judge and they are not a Mason, that is illegal.
Yeah, well, look at. Let me tell you
You're
what you can use the. Let me tell you what you can use.
They
the rules
documented that in
yeah.
the rules of court.
Unbelievable.
If he gives it to him and he's not a Mason, huh?
Yeah, it's illegal.
Oops.
Jeez. Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Make sure you don't give any of those Mason signs in court now, Gerard.
I'm still learning them. I don't know yet.
So what we did when we were studying, we started putting our hands under our chins and started waving to each other.
Isn't that the Three Stooges sign?
Yeah,
that's
right.
The one, yeah.
Yeah.
hey, listen, somebody brought it up. I think it was Jason. There is no Stephen Dean fund, legal fund at this time. Is that correct?
Well, look, we're going to be doing something for him. To my knowledge, there isn't.
Well, they had an address you could send funds to. I don't remember. I saw.
Yeah, you'd have to call Eric and ask him if there's.
Yeah, there was somebody collected money for him because he's sort of destitute. I don't know if you know that. He doesn't really have a home at this point.
Okay. Hey, listen. You know, I try to stress that there is enough information to study for the administrators on NLA that I try to, when we have our meetings, I try to keep it so we just are using NLA material. A lot of people want to bring their own material into the discussion, which I think is counterproductive if we have
yeah,
enough information
it's
to
a
study
very
already.
It's a very dangerous thing for them to do because, unfortunately, and look, we're guilty of the same thing. We fell into the same trap. We went on to websites to learn, and we became poisoned. We started the UCC stuff, the different kinds of bills and this and that, all this stuff, go and do declarations, doing all the stuff that doesn't do anything, doesn't give us any power. It makes us really, they're probably laughing at us when we do those things. And the way we wrote our papers, Man of the Soil and all that garbage, that's all the enemy stuck in this stuff out there and laughing at us, in my opinion. Or people coming up with these conclusions. Look, just get away from all that stuff. And you can rest assured everything that we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance is research. We challenge anyone to bring correction to us. And from time to time we make mistakes, we'll take the correction. But look, we have done the research. We know what we're talking about. We're laying it out the way it is. So we can work with a sure footing in the courts because we're not guessing, we're not relying on when he said, she said. And I can tell you there's a heck of a lot of poison out there, a lot of poison. You got to take the antidote. It's called truth. Do your own research or and, you know, look at our research. We have footnotes. We show everybody everywhere where our authorities and our information comes from. We're full of footnotes.
Well, let me one last question here for the which I think I'm going to stump you on, as far as this Stephen Dean case, we understand that the judge did not sign the warrant.
Yeah, but look, they're in fantasy land and just not just the fiction land. I mean, really fantasy land. And you know, it was mentioned to his lawyer, and his lawyer said, "Well, so what? There was a grand jury indictment." Well, wait a second here. That doesn't matter. Look, when the grand jury makes an indictment, they don't put the warrant out. That's the judge's business to put the warrant out. Why does the judge require to be put out? Because the judge wants to make sure everything has been done in order, and that all the authorities and all of the evidence is there, and that's his duty. Okay, so he takes the paperwork, and in the paperwork needs to be affidavits. If there is no affidavit that's been given to that jury, someone with a sworn statement or come to be sworn in, and affidavits to back up, if those things are not there, then the grand jury was never appropriately approached, nor have they appropriately made any decisions, because they have to act on facts, not hearsay, not a story, not presumptions, not a picture. If there's a picture, someone has to come in and verify that picture. Okay, so everything has to be verified. Now, when the judge gets that paperwork, he's to look at that and make sure, okay, yeah, everything, there's affidavits and, yeah, the jury's true bill and all this other stuff. Okay, now he signs the summons, I mean the arrest warrant.
Warrant.
That's the check.
It's a check and balance. That's
right. So that didn't happen, nor was there an attached affidavit. Why? Because he has a right to confront his accuser. So if the cop is the accuser, he needs to do an affidavit. They never do affidavits. They never get sworn in unless they have to, but they certainly did bring the story. And ultimately, the cop didn't bring the story into the jury. I'm sure it was the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, that brought it in. And it was probably, none of it was done in order. Look at, my goodness, we're looking at their jury questionnaire sheets. I mean, they want to know all kinds of stuff that's ridiculous. I mean, who are these people? They want to know if you've been in the service. They want to know certain things. It just goes on and on and on to ridiculous questions. What they're doing is profiling. That's what they're doing.
Hey, John, I'm going to close with one last comment. I had recently, which I'm a little bit suspect about, I had recently received a federal jury duty application.
Right.
I'm just suspect about that.
Right. Yeah, I received the state county recently a couple of times. I just threw them away.
Okay. Well, listen, I'll let you guys go and keep up the good work. We're supporting you out here.
Okay.
Thank you. Yep. Okay.
Right. Look, you could take one more as long as it's a quick, but then we got to end it. It's after hour now, but go ahead. Take one more quick one.
Okay.
1 minute or two.
Okay. 9691, you're unmuted.
Hi, my name's Jim, and I have a question as far as the DHS situation that I've been involved in. And basically DHS showed up.
Department of Homeland Security?
No.
DHS.
CPS. I'm sorry.
Oh, CPS.
Yeah, CPS.
Okay.
Yeah, CPS. I apologize. They showed up at the house while I was at work, and my wife was home, and basically told her to let me know that I was not allowed to come home, that some accusations had been made against me, and didn't give any idea what the accusations were or anything. This has been about a year ago. And I did never heard anything from them for months, and then they called me, interviewed me, still didn't tell me exactly what the accusations were. I'd hired the first attorney, didn't know, very scared, apprehensive, hired the attorney, felt like this attorney was very close to DHS and wasn't sure if she was really working on my side or with them. So in finding out, the accusations were that that I had sexually molested one of my cousins while I was working at their house. And there's a long story that goes into this. I'm trying to figure out how to condense it. Long story short, I hired a different attorney. The attorney did absolutely nothing for me, was never in contact with me, never worked through things with me. And finally,
psychosexual and all that. Polygraph.
Yeah, the only thing that attorneys know how to do is cash checks. But good.
And boy, she obviously did a good job at that. And so through pressure and stuff through DHS, the case finally got. There's never been an arrest. There's never been charges put against me. But they pressured my wife into filing for a divorce. And now, which time I cannot see my three stepdaughters at all, and our biological son that we had together.
Let me suggest what you want to do. You want to call, get a hold of Gina, join the group, get involved, and do whatever you can to help the group along and join the
absolutely.
We're doing habeas corpuses for all these children, and so that's what I suggest for you to do. But with that, we got to go because we're beyond our time.
That was all hearsay, too. They had no right to act on that.
Right. This is common. They always do this to the man. Always.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I've been hearing. Thank you.
Okay.
And I am with you. God bless you guys for being out there.
Thank you. Right. God bless you, too.
Thank you. Just one real quick here. I see John R. Wasn't you on before? John R., you're unmuted. Didn't you come on? Didn't we just speak? Or maybe we didn't get him out of the queue. Is that what happened?
I don't know.
Okay.
No, I've just been hitting next question. He usually go out.
Yeah, because he's USMC. So
well, we got a couple of guys that are UFMC.
Yeah, and a couple of them I wanted to get a hold of because they had certain backgrounds that would work good with our investigating committee. So, okay, but anybody who wants to get into our committee, especially investigating, anybody who's got a police background, particularly as a detective or an investigator of some kind, that kind of thing, we need some assistance. We're trying to create a committee. Give us a call, and we'll see once whether you want to take on the position. So we're looking for a director for this particular committee. Okay, with that, we're going to end it. Thanks, everyone, for calling. I think it was a good call. We had a lot of good questions. And Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Don't forget, we have a board meeting. We didn't announce this. We have a board meeting tomorrow, Tuesday, at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard. We'll send out an email to let everyone know. The only ones that could speak at the meeting are the directors of the different committees or the group leaders, coordinators. Those are the people. They're going to be given reports. We're going to be talking about different things. And we do like to get as many people as involved as possible, and hopefully by coming to these meetings, they'll connect with these different committees and start working with them, and maybe we'll form some new committees and because we have a lot of work to do. Okay, again, thanks, everyone. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And again, the board meeting tomorrow night right here in this room, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to end with a song, and then we'll close out. Thanks for coming.
Hey.
Close.